Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight the topic of discussion is how has television evolved? Joining me for this question, or this range of questions, are Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Hugh Kenneth David. Say hello.
Hello.
And Perry Seibert. Say hello.
Hello, everybody.
Yes, yes. So, you know, now for long-time listeners, you may be going, wait, didn't you do something like this a long time ago? Yeah, we did, but that was focusing more on certain aspects. This is going to be a bit broader. And I think that we're going to have to kind of say that this is definitely going to be one episode that's going to get into a lot of details. We may, depending on how much fun and how much we cover, do another one of these at some point in the near future. But what we're going to get is we're going to get a little bit of literally technically how television evolved physically, but also how it's evolved as an art form. So what we're looking at is, you know, yes, literally the TV sets, but also broadcast standards and things like that. But we're not going to dig into that too much. About 95% of the show is going to be how TV went from, well, what you saw right after World War II through the 50s into the 60s, and how television kept evolving until it became what we know now. And we can always have the argument of, well, is television better now than it was, or is it just different? This is all part of the topic. So if that sounds interesting, please continue listening. And that said, I think the first question is going to be, how do we define television in this current age? I mean, you know, what is TV? There's cable, there's streaming, there are still over-the-air services. People watch their TV via apps. They, you know, even things like ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, the CW, they have applications that you can watch streaming versions of them on your computer or your phone. So how do we really define television? And I'll go with you to start this topic, Hugh.
Okay, for me, I think this is probably the era where the definitions are just melting away and it's actually a lot harder to define what we mean by the word. I mean, everything you've just mentioned is very much about the way the medium is now received by individuals, whereas before it was very much a sense of this was a device in the corner of the home in the public area, i.e. the lounge, or, and it was therefore, in Britain certainly, the attitude was that it's a guest in the home. And so there was a great deal of consideration by the people making the programming that this was an intrusive window within the home sphere and had to be considered as such, you know, the entertainment that went out on it, the presenters, the way they spoke, all of this thing. Technically, the definition in most, you know, books, dictionaries, what have you, is it relates initially, the initial definition relates to the technology, right? It's television is defined as the transmission over the airwaves of images and sounds. You know, that are, and they usually add the word transient in as well, which I think is quite interesting considering everybody, you know, think these days it's about content that is repeatable and deliverable and pausable. But at the time, you know, the definition was very much about transient images and sound, you know, that can be picked up and viewed at a distance from where they started. And that in itself, I'm not sure has changed. You know, what we send over the medium. Yeah, okay, there's a lot of room for discussion there. But ultimately, it's still people picking up a device and seeing and hearing things that aren't local to them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that when I was growing up, you know, it was that's what television was. It was that thing in the corner. Sometimes it was on, sometimes it wasn't. And you didn't really think much of it other than when it was on. And now it seems to become much more broadly defined and much more ubiquitous. So what about you, Aaron?
Well, I mean, we tend to define things by, you know, self-definition, even though that doesn't actually make a word, right? You can't define something by itself.
Damn,
so,
that rule,
like,
in English.
The medium is the message is pretty much dead now, because there is no medium. It is, everything is television and cinema at the same time. I mean, they're both motion picture arts. So at this point, you have to ask yourself what differentiates television from cinema. And you can't even say, well, one goes to movie theaters now because of COVID. That hasn't been the case for a year and a half, 2 years. So I guess it comes down to length. Television is defined by being, you know, both shorter and longer than a movie. It has short episodic things that make up a longer piece than a story that can be told in a movie theater. Or it is something that plays literally on a television. That's not something that used to play on a cinema. Like I said, like, these definitions are all getting so blurred now. Like, I guess you know it when you see it, like pornography.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So, Perry, you?
I had this out to about a half a page at one point and drilled it down to this couple of sentences for me, okay? It's anything that is episodic in nature that was created with the understanding that you will walk away from it and stop it and come back to it at any point. That's the difference between film and television.
You know, I like,
you are expected,
I like that,
to sit and watch a film. It requires your attention in the moment. And that makes me sound like I like television less. I don't like television less, but I have a hard time calling television, especially commercial television, I have a much harder time calling that art than I do cinema.
Well, you know, I will say this. I like the idea that it can be put down and come back to, and that's part of television. But, you know, I will say this. I'm enough of a snob. And anyone that's listened to this show probably has figured out that I'm a bit of a snob. You know, I probably should have an eye patch, a monocle, and a elbow patches, and a smoking jacket somewhere, and a big old study out of Captain Nemo's lounge. But, you know, or Henry Higgins, maybe. But, you know, you look at something like Twin Peaks, The Return, which had its first several hours screened at Cannes and got a, you know, standing ovation, and mm-hmm. people called it the movie event of the year, but it was really television. And David Lynch wanted you to see the whole thing, but he also wanted you to watch it bit by bit. And I think that's one thing that, you know, television has grown, particularly in terms of the quality of the content and how the pieces fit together. But for me, I'd have to say that my definition of television in this age, it's a little bit of everything that you said, but I'll go with you on one thing, Perry. I have a hard time looking at a lot of commercial television, and by that I mean much of anything on ABC, CBS, NBC, or Fox as having as much artistic merit as what you find with the best streaming and cable shows. Now, that's not to say that you don't come across a truly profound show once in a while, you know, say a person of interest or a good place, things like that. They do still exist. And, of course, back in the day we had other shows that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But it's just not what it was. You know, television, television I think, was kind of always seen from the earliest days the way that the studios used to see movies. You know, movies weren't supposed to be art. They were supposed to be a product. They were supposed to make money, and they were, well, as Hugh said, a transient thing. It came, it went, and when it was gone, you weren't supposed to give it much thought, and whatever money was made off of it was made off of it, and that was that. But in the current age, you know, with the advent of DVDs, Blu-rays, and, of course, streaming collections, not to mention, cable, it's quite a different matter these days. I mean, I remember when I was younger, one of my favorite shows was Babylon 5. This was a show that had a fully fleshed story arc. If you missed an episode, you could miss a lot, and it was syndicated. Well, the local station that was syndicating it decided to stop showing it early in the third season. They brought it back towards the end of the third season, beginning of the fourth season. There was no way in hell I was going to be able to catch up on it. Now, about a year and a half later, maybe two years later, TNT got the rights to start airing it as a whole, because they decided to do the fifth season, and I was able to go back and watch it. And that sort of thing, you know, that's the sort of thing where streaming been a thing, had DVDs been a thing back then, I wouldn't have been nearly as worried. But back 25 years ago, 96, 97, goddamn, time flies. You know, the last quarter century has seen just massive upheavals in the way that we watch. So, you know, could we maybe agree that modern television isn't exactly one thing but a whole bunch of things? Would that perhaps be fair to say? Aaron?
Yes, I agree.
Hugh?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you nailed it.
Perry?
I would agree with the slightest pushback that I don't, mm-hmm. I don't, for me, the distinction isn't cable or network. It is commercial or not commercial. If you're for a commercial break, you're still, that's way closer to being what you were calling network television for me, as great as some cable shows have been and are. If you're writing for a commercial break, you're doing something different than what they can do on HBO, Showtime, and streaming services.
Yep. And you know, and that's why you know, that's probably one of the reasons why I found you know, Person of Interest such a great show, was because, or even say The Good Place, because yeah, you know, they had to deal with the commercial breaks, but it almost felt, or they did such a damn good job of not really seeming to care about building to those, commercial. Like, you know, you watch an episode of even something like ER or Cheers or Frasier, and you can tell where the commercials came in. The West Wing, you can tell where the commercials came in. But Twin Peaks, Homicide... Not so much. Person of Interest, sometimes. But yeah, you know, you do have a point. You know, that forced break does hurt it artistically. But you know, moving on to the next topic. You know. And I guess we've kind of covered the next question, which is going to be, what is the major difference between television in the immediate post-war days and now, aside from more channels? Although I guess we could get into that. Aaron, what would you say the one of the major differences really is?
The television itself has totally changed, and they can make things, for lack of a better word, more cinematic. I think that production values in television shows is a lot better, even on things that are literally made to just sell laundry soap. I think that while it is still viewed in like the motion picture industry as little brother and as kind of second class, that the quality has increased to such a point that it's becoming harder to differentiate just based on sheer quality of the product.
Perry?
I have two answers, one nuts and bolts and one philosophical for this. Nuts and bolts answer is the VCR and the DVR. We can control. We get to decide when and where we're going to watch things. That couldn't have been conceived of in the late 40s. I think that is the most radical change that's truly affected how everything gets created. And although I guess this, the more philosophical answer is basically saying that there's just more channels, you know, what's gone is the sense of the primacy of it in the culture. There isn't a community around it. It's not a monoculture anymore. And so, yeah, I know, I guess I mean that to be a little deeper than just there's more channels.
You
know,
missed the water cooler thing that used to happen.
Right. Other than in America, football, there is no television show that everybody is talking about the next day.
Yeah.
So, Hugh, what about you?
I think for me, it's always going to have to be going right back when to the moment where it became possible to transmit pre-recorded material en masse as opposed to doing it live. Because until that point, you are basically doing theater to a camera. And any recordings you have, at least in Britain, it's, you know, tele-recordings. You're pointing a camera at the screen to record the transmission as it airs, right? So that's why we have so much material from the first few decades lost and missing and unavailable to us. You know, it wasn't recordable. It was literally putting, you know, radio and theater out there with visuals. And that required a completely different way of making television. The fact that the first two, you know, the first 3 years of the Avengers, you know, the fact that Honor Blackman had to learn how to go and change her outfits in the ad break, and then, you know, pretend walk through the door in the next scene like she hadn't just beaten up three stuntmen, you know, and pretend she's perfectly calm. You know, we don't that sort of stuff is not required anymore. You know, you do not need to shoot around that. You do not need to plan that around the ad break. You do not need to do any of the work that we used to do for that. You know, everything can be prepped ahead of time, planned, stored, shot, at which point it starts to become far more like cinema. And I think that therefore makes it a crucial change. You know, that's why you get, and I'm just using the Avengers as an example, but that's why you go from, you know, those earlier episodes which are shot by people who were television directors of the era. And then the moment you flip over to Diana Rigg's era and they're pre-filming everything and the whole thing is shot like a movie, you start to use the people who are actually movie directors, you know, on television.
So, Perry, here's a question that kind of follows on from what we've been asking. But, you know, what aspect of television has really changed the least from its earliest days? I mean, other than obviously we watch things on a smaller screen, or it's made for at-home viewing.
I the with of course the grand caveat that we're talking about a large chunk of television, I say with air quotes, that don't have them anymore, commercials. Commercials is what hasn't changed. It's the reason there's television. Speaking quite specifically about American TV. They're there to get you to watch the minute between. And that, and now we've gotten, I mean, we'll never get away from it. I love the story that Netflix is going to now have a slightly cheaper plan in which there'll be commercials now. Great. We're paying to watch commercials. Great. You know, this is the commercials.
Yeah, $16 instead of
$19. Television is. Television is commercials. Commercials is television. There's no way around it. That's what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, you've mentioned the commercials before, and I think that's interesting. You know, I have to say that I'm glad for cable, and I'm glad for DVDs and Blu-rays and streaming because, you know, I even watch YouTube. You know, I think a lot of us watch YouTube for various reasons. And when I see an ad pop up on YouTube, I'm pissed. I'm honestly pissed. When I start something up on Amazon or Hulu, even though I've got the ad-free Hulu, that doesn't mean completely ad-free. Sometimes you'll see like a five-second bumper. It just means your show doesn't get interrupted. I'm a little miffed. I'm annoyed. I'm annoyed that I have to wait 30, 40, 60, 90 seconds through one, two, three, or four quick ads. Now, that people may say, wow, you're impatient. No, I never liked it. And until I got away from it, I never realized how much I didn't like it. And, you know, we've talked a little bit earlier about how it seems to disrupt the rhythm and the flow of what you're watching. And that really is probably why, for me, I can't do network TV anymore. I mean, people will say, hey, are you watching this? I'm like, no. Once the season's over, I'll watch it in chunks. I'll watch it in big chunks off of Netflix or Hulu or Amazon. Whoever gets it, I'll watch it then. Because, damn it, I don't want it. not even if I was to DVR it and fast-forward it. You know, about the only time I'm going to do that with shows that have commercials, I'll do it for something like Better Call Saul, because I think that's the best show on TV right now, and I can actually fast forward it. But I'm not going to care that much about, say, the newest episode of the new Wonder Years. Lovely shows that may have been. I'm not going to sit there every week and fast forward through 12 minutes of commercials to watch 18 minutes of show.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, for Better Call Saul, I don't mind, you know, taking 1 minute to go through 10 minutes of commercial and get 50 minutes of show that's that profound. But still, you know, even a show like Better Call Saul, shows like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, they had commercials. There's lots of great shows that have had commercials, even on, you know, super premium cable. And, you know, you really can't get away from commercials. I mean, it's not, you know, the way the commercials used to be back in the 50s, but it still all serves the same purpose. What about you, Hugh?
I mean, it's interesting because, of course, I have the advantage of having grown up in Britain, so, you know, we have the BBC.
Yeah.
The discussions over here are very different. You know, yes, we've had ITV since, hang on, I had the date down earlier. I mean, ITV kicked off in the 50s, so we've had commercial television that long. But because of the legal requirements in Britain to have a minimum amount of educational content and news and all of these things that we think of as like the way the schedule is broken up as standard, you know, stuff for kids in the morning, stuff for housewives in the afternoon, stuff for everybody in the early evening, stuff for the adults in the late evening, you know, all of that evolved partly around the demands that were placed first on the BBC and then on ITV. You know, to get a commercial contract, you couldn't just be a television network in the region offering any old imported tat or homemade tat. You had to have an idea of what you were going to do and work with people with reputations and so forth and so on. So it's a very different argument over here in some ways. You know, a lot of people who worked in one format would move to the other and vice versa. And yes, the ad break was always seen as an issue, but it was also seen as, well, it reduces the amount of time I have. And you go back and look at some of these earlier shows, and the idea, the thing I always associated myself growing up in the 70s with American television was that I always associated the need to write and create the story to get you to come back after the ad break was paramount. Whereas in Britain, there were certain shows that where they just didn't care. The ad break was irrelevant. You know, the beat and the story where the ad break happened was perforce the beat that you would have had as a turning point or as a dramatic point, regardless if you were on BBC. You just had to write 3 minutes less worth of material. And I think that in itself speaks volumes about the kind of people who got involved in the format, got stuck into it. And I think that changed, that makes for a very different set of parameters and debates. You know, everything in Britain is fundamentally based around Lord Reith, the original Governor General of the BBC. You know, the what we call the Reithian principles, because he believed fundamentally in the medium as being the most powerful new medium to come along in human history, and he fundamentally believed that part of the remit with it was to educate as well as to entertain and inform. Those three aspects, educate, entertain, inform, were the Reithian principles that guided the BBC in terms of television BBC, and that idea is still managed to there was an element of that still in commercial television. I mean, eventually, obviously, that was eroded, but as it was everywhere else, and the interaction between British television and American television, you know, goes to the heart of that. And then you get writers and directors and producers and all these people coming up here in Britain who are looking at American TV going, well, actually, we want to be more like that. And then I think the most obvious example is The Sweeney. You know, the entire point of The Sweeney was, we want to make American style cop movies in Britain, and literally, you know, the first two-thirds of most Sweeney episodes are British standard British police fare from the 60s, basically just dressed up in the 70s. But the third act is always some insane stunt sequence that frequently has stunts that make, I'm saying this as the person who, because I used to work for Network DVD, you know, I had to market the reissue, the HD reissue of Sweeney season one. So I know where I want to speak on this. You know, the third act of the first episode, there's a car chase which they used to shoot down in Hammersmith near where my offices were at the time. And there's a car chase around an empty warehouse, and what do you know? The Jaguar suddenly manages to go up a ramp, take off, fly through a bunch of barrels and blow up in midair for no reason whatsoever. Right?
I think that's the least realistic thing a Jaguar's ever done. Well, the most realistic thing is not allowing Lane Price on Mad Men to actually off himself.
Yeah, exactly. But that's a diversion.
But I have to say this, guys. I couldn't have been the only person that as soon as we knew Lane was going to off himself, didn't any of you turn to whoever you were watching it with and say, you just know he's going to try and suffocate himself with that Jaguar, and it's not going to turn over. Because I know I did. I turned to the person I was watching it with, and they were like, no, oh, yeah, they would on this show, wouldn't they? But, you know, Jaguar blowing up, oh, you know, I mean, what was that thing, the Pinto? Wasn't it the Pinto that had a reputation for blowing up?
Probably, but from over here, it looked like any car in an American film blew up at some point.
Yeah, it was maybe that was it. It was that
unsafe at any speed.
for damn sure.
I got us away from the main question, but I just feel that the terms of the debate are very different over here. And given that we're in the year where they're trying to basically get rid of the BBC's license fee and commercialize it, I think You know, there is that may seem incredibly quaint to people outside of Britain that that is a thing that we are worried about. But actually,
yeah,
the very thing that the government...
Look at what's happened with Doctor Who. Look what's happened with Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Doctor Who is now no longer just a BBC show. It's been slightly outsourced to Sony and Bad Wolf.
You need to understand, we've been doing that for years now. That's the thing. That's like the great, the dirty secret behind the BBC is they made the BBC commit to outsourcing years ago. And I think the first major company I remember coming up on my radar doing it, it was, what is the name of the company that was behind Spooks? I've forgotten their name now. Anyway, those guys became the number one out.
Does it start with a V?
No, it begins with something else. Anyway, that's
where... I was thinking it was something like Visual Max or something, but...
Yeah, anyway, those guys were the first example of a commercial production house doing things with a B, but then everything these days is outsourced to people who used to be providers for ITV or Channel 4. It came a long time ago, and that was the first step in the direction of where we are now. But on the other hand, it's always been seen as potentially saving the BBC because it allowed for people who normally worked in commercial formats to suddenly have a go at doing things without the ad break. And I think ultimately that's always the thing, isn't it? I think a lot of what we think is about television in terms of programming, you know, we talked about commerce, we talked about, you know, the need for the ad break, the need to sell things, and Perry's point about, you know, the moment you write with knowing the ad break is in mind, then, you know, that is going to affect the quality of what you're doing. I mean, you know, I think that's true, and yet at the same time, as I said over here, that because we had less ad breaks per hour, I think it took a while before that really, really, truly, made such a radical difference to the storytelling, because you had to have breaks before, and especially if you go back to the live broadcast versions, they had to build in moments in the live broadcast where things could be changed or modified, just like in the theatre. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. I've lost my point. Sorry. Let me get back to the
Hey, look, live radio.
Yeah. No commercial breaks.
Nope. So, Aaron?
What was the original question now?
What aspect of television has changed the least from the earliest days?
Oh, yeah, I guess I have to agree with Perry, the commercials, and you know, the episodic nature of it. We're still doing 30-minute sitcoms and 45-minute dramas, and so... I guess the format, too, the fact that we build a prime time around a time that families used to hang out after supper before bed. So, I mean, I think if you look at typical broadcast networks, not much has actually changed other than the technology. I think, like, the ethos of television is the same as it always was on the major networks anyway.
Well, you know, you just mentioned technology, and that leads into our next question, and it's one that I thought that I'd sent along, but apparently our messaging system ate the question. I just noticed that it said undelivered. So the one real technical question that I was going to ask was a two or three part question. I'm not sure how well you guys will be able to answer this without having had lots of prior thought. And that is, you know, now as far as I understand it, over in Europe and the United Kingdom, they've always had slightly higher standards as far as say, you know, lines of data. You know, it was 480 here, mm-hmm. and I think, what was it, Hugh, like 520 or something?
Yeah, 600. We started, I think we started at the very, very first transmissions in the 1930s were 30 line, and then it moved up to very quickly after the war into 500 and 600. I think it settled at 620, but I'll have to double check.
Yep. And you were actually the one I was going to start this topic with was that the technical thing. I mean, the broadcast standards, just that part alone, it's evolved immensely. I mean, people look at old television and say, oh, it looks crappy, especially they, you know, even stuff that's been beautifully cleaned up from the 50s, like, say, The Honeymooners or I Love Lucy, you know, they've done these wonderful restoration jobs on some of these old shows, but it still doesn't look that great because even though it was, you know, not all of it was actually filmed. Some of it was on videotape, and it was a videotape that didn't capture the original, you know, the full depth that you'd get with something else. But the thing is those old teeth. I'm losing my point here. Let me start over. It's not only the physical look of the shows themselves, which can be great now, but when you saw them broadcast, a 480 screen is not going to give you the same quality as a screen now. Not even if you found an original, say, color TV, and you could watch something in color, there is a lot less information. And TV looks different now than it ever did. And it's not just the bells and whistles. It's also the fact that, well, would you say it's fair to say that the technology change, the and just from a visual standpoint, has helped people accept television as something more than, well, as you and Perry put it, a transient thing, to more of an art form? Has that been something that's really been a boon, or is that just a side effect?
Okay, so I think there are two elements to this for me personally. Just to briefly, very briefly recap on the history of this, right? Just very briefly. So it's 1935 in Britain when the Television Advisory Committee decide to look at the various standards that are being developed around the world. Now, John Logie Baird, who's, you know, widely credited with developing television transmissions in Scotland and Britain, his original television was based on 30 lines. Okay. However, EMI, which was formed in 31, was busy working on an electronic-based television camera, which they developed in secret. They then went public in 34, and so that's at the point where we developed what they called back then high definition, I should point out. It was called high definition format, which were 240 lines or greater. And so Baird had a 240 line mechanical system. Marconi and EMI had the 405 line electronic system. So already you can start to see where we're heading at this point, because, of course, we're going to see international choices made about which system they're going to use and how it's going to work. And so the BBC finally switches over to these sorts of programs in 1936. So even before the war, right, we have electronic television, and that makes a big difference what can be transmitted. You know, I mean, when they first started out, they had to use a radio transmitter and alternate images and sound separately, like in the days of silent movies, you know, you had to have one or the other. Whereas, you know, you now get to the point where, you know, it's something that can be bought, looked at home, and it's a much bigger deal. And that change is first taken advantage of with the coronation of King George in Britain, and that's in 1937. They sell 9,000 TV sets just in London alone in order for people to see that. So that, and of course, you can see there at that point, we're saying, right, let's go with 405 lines, and people are like, people can see the difference. Obviously, at that point, you know, World War II comes along, and so they shut down television, But at that point, we reckon there's about 20,000 sets in Britain. So during the war, the technology goes on, and they develop the 600-line stereoscopic, what they want Baird called stereoscopic television. And then there was the first, after the war, there's the first transmission of the Olympics and so forth and so on. So at every point in its history, the technology, the visual element, the what you can see has always been a selling point. I can remember what a big deal it was in Britain when we started getting, you know, TVs that were big enough that it wasn't just a small square behind the bartender in the pub, you know? It's like something big that people want to go and watch the game on. And I feel like along the way, it's always this back and forth between the people who are making the content that's going to go out and whether or not they see what they're doing as a job that has to be just to produce stuff on a regular basis or whether they see what they're doing as reaching artistic levels. And I think that's a huge discussion within the industry. And I think the industry either follows the tech, oh, we have this new tech, we need to do something for it. And in that sense, in Britain, live broadcast is often ahead of everyone else in using the technology. You know, they first started trying high definition was basically sold in this country, as in modern high definition, was basically sold in this country off the back of football because it meant you had better quality large screens in pubs. That was basically what helped bring the price down. But then in terms of drama and art, you obviously then have people looking at it going, oh, my God, we can do movie quality now. You know, and so it's this constant back and forth, this constant discussion that revolves between creators and the technologists, and you know, and you can widen that out to all sorts of areas. You know, especially when we then talk about the interaction between television and cinema. You know, and people going, oh wait, well I'd rather stay home and watch this. You know, oh wait, no, we need people back in the cinema, so we're going to have to develop Technicolor and widescreen and all the rest of it. You know, these are ongoing discussions that I don't think have ever ended, and I think actually a lot of people who discuss television and the art versus commerce debate, I think there's a lot of people out there who don't often consider the tech quite as much. I'm glad that tonight we're doing that.
Yeah, and you know, it was something I wanted to bring up a little more, and I want to also clarify that I wasn't trying to say that earlier, because I know I got lost there. I know you guys understand this, but just for anybody else out there, no, I wasn't suggesting necessarily that older television shows will always look bad because they were made on that technology, but there wasn't the, like Hugh just said, they weren't as worried about the cinematic presentation, and that's why even when you clean up artifacts and such, and they're not going to look as polished. But, you know, you look at something like, you look at the Blu-rays of the Quatermass experiment, or you look at the Blu-rays
That was going to be my next comment. Quatermass is
Or you look at the Blu-rays The Honeymooners, and people remember this on old televisions. They remember this in the days of what's now standard definition television, and they say, those things looked like shit. Well, you know, they really didn't look like shit. It's just our televisions looked like shit, and we didn't realize it, because you look at stuff that, say, I'm going to use the YouTube example. Go to YouTube, grab a clip of some TV show from, say, 95 or before. It's not just the fact that you're watching a copy off of an old VHS, although that's part of it. It was broadcast at a lower standard, and it looks muddy. Folks, this is what television looked like for ages and ages and ages. I think that's part of why people didn't take it seriously, because you went to the theater and it looked different. It looked better. It looked lusher. But now with high definition, with these fucking 80-inch OLED screens with enough light in them to blot out, you know, to blind people up in the International Space Station, you know, putting IMAX to shame, it's just not comparable. But yeah, you said you had a comment on Quatermass.
You know, all I was going to say was I find it fascinating that when we look at the people who became obsessed enough with television to start becoming, you know, historians of it, critics of it, people who talked about it and took it seriously, a lot of them, you look back at their childhoods and the things that they remember the most, and then as they grow up, they still cite to this day, are those things where it is, despite the snow falling down the screen and the black and white and everything you said, you know, the writing, the acting, occasionally, yes, the costumes, the lighting, you know, but all of that breaks through, you know, and I feel like that is the essential quality that makes some of these things art, regardless of the production circumstances. You know, if you make something that impacts on the viewer to such a degree that we are not only still talking about it 30, 40, 60 years later, but we're looking for, trying to find versions of it that we can see. You know, one of the reasons I loved working at Network DVD was the joy of being able to see things before anyone else that we were pulling out of the archive and upgrading for DVD, let alone Blu-ray. And I, you know, one of the first jobs I worked on was The Strange World of Gurney Slade. And
yeah,
the, being able
I was just
to
gonna
sit
think about
there
that.
And, yeah, you know, being able to walk into the studio and look, be shown, you know, a cleaned up, you know, DVD definition, just beautiful, pristine black and white of something that nobody had watched since the mid-80s on Channel 4 and before, and not before that, not since the 60s, you know, and to have it and to be able to see it, and it suddenly impacts you again and it's fresh. You know, the thing that blew my mind away was like, this is what Mitchell and Webb are doing with Peep Show on BB, right now, and it, you know, he did it in the early 60s. You know, that blew my mind, and I think it's just about having that ability to recognize that the technology isn't always the issue if the quality of what's there matters. And you know, I'm really looking forward to looking at the BFI's recent reissue of the 1954 version of 1984 that the BBC did, which has been legendarily
the Peter Cushing,
you know,
one.
Unable to be released. Sorry,
the Peter Cushing,
yeah,
one.
The Cushing one. Yeah, Nigel Neal Cushing.
I saw that off of YouTube, and yep, it was. Somebody had taped off a television, probably in the 90s, but I didn't care because at least I got to see it. And I saw it, oh, I'm going to say maybe 2014, 2015.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a great movie. That is a great there have been lots of versions of 1984, but that is easily my favorite version. So the fact
well,
that
this
the Blu-ray
is the thing,
of it, I'm going to have to hunt it.
Yeah, people who saw it had you know, talked about it for years. I'd heard about it for years. I mean, it was one of the most requested titles when I worked at Network. And, you know, the fact that my mate Ben over at the BFI has actually managed to get it out now is a real testament to hard-nosed negotiation with the right people. But the fact is the Blu-ray is out now and it can be bought very easily. And that is, you know, I think that's a remarkable achievement, even though what we're seeing is a high-definition version of the telly recording. You know, it's not, because of course it wasn't shot, you know, we didn't have the ability to keep the video the way we did that. You know, as I said, you used to point a camera at the TV screen and shoot a film of what was on screen. And so, you know, we have to accept the limitations. We absolutely do, because it doesn't matter. It's just the limitations can be overcome by the creative force of the people performing, and then you know, it doesn't matter what the tech is.
So, Aaron, do you have anything to add here?
No, I don't think I do.
What about you, Perry?
The only thing I would say, what this put me in mind of, and that was fantastic history. Thank you for that, Hugh.
No, you're welcome.
James Burroughs, who's, I think, I'm going to go so and say, like, the best American sitcom director ever, right?
Easily. He did with Cheers alone is monumental.
Right. And he said, you know, that television, a sitcom especially, is a radio show with pictures. And and so he would work his cast, every cast he worked with, to the point that they were, he would call them director proof. And that, I'm bringing this up only to point out that, yes, it got looking better and better, and I don't think most people care. The makers don't care. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I truly mean nothing pejorative about this, but it just doesn't matter. As long as
mm-hmm.
it's good
yep.
enough, until it starts to look so bad, they realize, okay, we kind of have to upgrade because this does look kind of bad. And it took until the last, I don't want to put a date on it, because I was recently rewatching. My wife and I are going through a show for the first time that was on in the mid-2000s. And all I could look at in that first season is, this looks like crap because those early awful digital cameras.
Okay, okay. Now you got to say the name of the show.
We're going through Veronica Mars. This is our nighttime show together.
I love that show, but I hear you.
Right, and I like the show. I'm saying, and to agree with your point, it does. I agree with you entirely.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. I'm agreeing with Burroughs and with you. Yes, an entertaining show will work no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
That won't bother me. And if it's something I don't like, oh, having it look crappy is not going to help at all. And I will hound on it.
I mean, let's look at something like I, Claudius. You know, I, Claudius is a filmed play. And, you know, it's got those very traditional BBC production values.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
but
mm-hmm.
my God, the acting, the writing,
mm-hmm.
it you know, if you groove to it, if it catches your fancy, you really just don't give a fuck.
Mm.
I mean, look, I love Babylon 5, but I will be the first to admit that the CGI has aged, and the advent of HD televisions has allowed us to see the seams where we didn't used to see them. But, you know, it doesn't really matter because it's what the show represents, and it's about the quality of the writing and, well, at least the main cast acting, because, look, I'm a huge D5 fanatic, but some of those supporting... But some of those background actors and one-offs were truly terrifyingly awful. we'll probably have another technical question a little bit later. But the next question is going to be for you, Perry, and that's going to be this. Excuse me, I'm so sorry, folks. I'm needing to catch my breath a little bit there. What's the worst development in TV since the early days? What is the absolute worst thing that's changed? Actually, let's see if we can both say it at the same time. One, two, three. Reality TV.
Reality TV. We did not plan that. I want people to understand we did not plan that.
No, we didn't.
Brilliant.
I swear to God,
brilliant.
We didn't.
Yeah. I try. I mean, I'm old. I understand. I get it. I confess to all of it. But I honestly am not being hyperbolic. I think reality TV is genuinely harmful to the culture. There is nothing safe or fun or good about it for me. And I understand this is an incredibly slippery slope. I watch Jeopardy every night and I live for it. But maybe the game show scandals make it clean for me. If it's a fair game, I'm going to watch. But Survivor is not that.
No.
Survivor is not a game. It's producers deciding who's going to win. American Idol is unwatchable for me because it kills both music and TV.
Fear Factor.
I don't care for
Big Brother.
I get Fear Factor for the sheer grossness of it. Okay, I understand the appeal, but I don't find that as harmful. Here's the moment. It was recently, just like this month, I turn on Hulu, and I've got a giant ad for an ABC News special about the Kardashians coming back to TV. And all I could think of was, it's not news and it's not special. That's everything that's wrong. That's
yep.
it.
Well, you know,
let's think about this.
The Kardashians were asked several years ago. They were sitting on some couch, and I saw this clip because it was making the rounds because people were like, see. And what had happened was somebody had asked the Kardashians, so why are you famous? what do you do that's made you famous? And those dumbasses couldn't come up with a real answer. The answer is they're a media creation. They're famous for being famous.
Yeah.
So
and those people have always
TV.
Existed.
Don't forget their dad won OJ's trial and Kim had a sex tape.
That's how they got
known.
That isn't how they got famous.
Yeah, you know, you can go all the way back to, you know, not for reality TV, you know, you can go all the way back to forgetting the Kardashians because let's please try to forget them. You can go all the way back to American Family, at least in the United States.
Oh.
And
you
that
go
at
back
least
to Queen for a day.
And those at least pretended to be a documentary, like a social documentary. And, you know, now Hugh and I discussed this when we did our show on Up and Michael Apted. But, you know, the Up series is a little bit of a reality series, but it's also a social documentary. But I hesitate to call it reality. It's been called a reality show. But for me, it's not a reality show. There's not a game element. And while people have said it's exploitive, you know, I don't think the purpose of it, the intent is to exploit. I think the original intent was to explore, and the exploitation came along later, and they've done some things in the last few episodes to try to lessen that. I think that's good, but I think it's something, like you said, Perry, it's harmful. And even the best examples that exist within or adjacent to the genre are harmful.
They're harmful if they sit there unexamined. That's the thing that I hate. That It is why my prejudice exists towards it's why I hold fiction film over documentaries in my heart. I'm not saying it's a greater art form. I just find them problematic.
The great Polish director Krzysztof Kozlowski began as a documentarian, and he stopped going for or doing documentaries because what was the quote, Aaron? You remember why he said he stopped? Because I'll let you
tell people stories without harming anyone,
yeah,
or without putting anyone in danger, or something along those lines. Like it was very.
I mean,
much
he wasn't
having to do with the government censorship and
not
wanting to put anyone in harm's way, basically.
Yeah.
I can see if I can find the actual quote.
But that brings me to you, Aaron. So what is your choice for worst development?
Well, it's hard to argue what you said. I would say that the game shows are less bad than stuff like the crap they're pushing on, like, TLC and History Channel and stuff that's just, like, let's watch famous people live their lives in a way that you can think that billionaires are okay they're not. Like, I don't care if some dude from Miami wants to live in a house for a summer and see if he can win $500,000. Like, I don't care if he wants to go to some remote island and see if he can win some money. I really don't.
Can he live,
like,
in a loincloth for 6 weeks?
Like, I don't have that kind of ambition, but if he wants to get weird famous, go for it. But I don't need to have the Kardashians or the Duck Dynasty guys or Honey Boo Boo or any of those people shoved in my face on a weekly basis and telling me that these are ways that are good to live your life, because they're not.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for me, like, those, like, that's real reality TV. Yeah, like, we all know that reality TV isn't real, but that's when I say reality TV, that's the stuff I mean. Like, who are the Duggars? and their rapist child who they keep protecting. Like, these are the people that I think are really doing irreparable harm to American culture, and I do agree that the reality TV is a virus that is causing much of it.
Yeah, you won't hear an argument from me. And finally to you, Hugh.
Okay, so I'm going to just very briefly want to touch on the reality TV moment, because I don't disagree with you guys, but I can remember seeing the very, very first UK Big Brother when it started. I can just remember the effects it had, because I was in teaching at the time, and I remember walking into the English department, and one of the teachers was she had a spare period for prepping lessons, and she had the computer on, and there's a guy on there shaving at 3 in the afternoon. I was like, what are you doing? She's like, I can't tear my eyes away from it. I was like, the guy's just shaving. I said, if you want to do that, you can come around my place in the morning. And she was like, yeah, no, okay, but it's there. I was just, I'm not really paying attention to it. I said, yes, you are, because you haven't marked it. There's not a single paper in front of you is marked. But I think, okay, so there is a change in the 90s, but I really feel like that is an entire conversation that we should really reserve for another podcast, because actually there's so much to talk about there. In
terms of
its
origins.
Absolutely,
and I was just going to say we definitely are going to be doing that later in the summer.
Yeah, absolutely, and I'd love to be involved in that, because one of my flatmate, when I first left teaching, went into IT, he was one of the programmers on the original website for the Channel 4 British version of Big Brother once they bought the license from Holland. And so he gave me horror stories of the producers. So anyway, I'll save that for then. What I wanted to say was, and also that means we can then talk about, you know, things that evolved into that, which I'm keeping for, you know, a little on the side for this show, things like Candid Camera. And then in Britain, we already had like criminal reconstruction, like true crime reconstruction stuff with Patrol Car. We had game shows like Double Your Money, and all that stuff starts so early on, right? I mean, Candid Camera starts in 1960 and runs for 15 years, you know? So I feel like there's a history of ridiculing ordinary people and setting them up, but that is so much more planned in some ways than the initial phase of the reality TV you guys are talking about. However, I think the worst thing that ever happened, at least in British television, but given the impact internationally, I'm going to cite this, and that is Rupert fucking Murdoch being born and developing Sky in 1989. Okay.
Yeah, that's the worst thing to television, and seriously one of the worst things to happen to the world in the 20th century.
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm not even going to get in. We know the positives that have come out of companies he started, okay? You know, we can talk about the things that, you know, Fox has or hasn't done in terms of drama and animation and that sort of thing, and not have to talk about the news division. But obviously we have to talk about the news division. We can't talk about one and not talk about the other. You know, we can't talk about the strike breaking he did as a newspaper magnate in Britain, but then the way he manipulated
and the shit he did with like
itself.
Yellow journalism with what was it, the Mirror and all that.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just transferred all of that into television. But he also set a precedent in terms of recognizing. So Sky went live when I was at university in my first year. And in the initial years, it was a mark of money. You could afford to get a satellite dish and a receiver. Therefore, you had to have a certain amount of money to do the subscription. As the 90s rolled on, it actually became something far more. It was more about where did you live that you had trouble getting standard, over the air reception for geographical reasons or what have you. So you paid for the box instead, and then cable came along and started to get, you know, fitted in various new estates, and kids learned how to, you know, pirate the signal so they didn't have to pay for the sub, and suddenly Sky became hugely influential. One of the ways it built up in Britain was by taking content that had been bought by free-to-air networks, and once it was proven to be successful, so for example, Star Trek Next Generation on BBC, 3 years in, it's become hugely successful in Britain, and they go, right, we're buying it now. And suddenly it's locked behind a paywall. And so this is the this is, at least in Britain, the beginning of the subscription network system that is obviously under massive discussion now in relation to streamers, you know? But the fact was that I literally couldn't watch Star Trek from season three, and anybody who knows what happens at the end of season three will know how irritating that is, because it's the cliffhanger on the Borg. And you're just like, that was one of the most manipulative things I'd ever seen at the time. The idea that you were saying to thousands of people in Britain, okay, if you want to see what happens to Picard as a Borg, you're going to have to pay money now. You know? Mm-hmm. And then they bought the Football League as well, you know, the transmission. And it was just this one thing after another. It was holding a population used to free-to-air television that we pay for through our licensing. Right? We basically pay a tax that funds it. And we were suddenly being told, no, you now got to pay extra to see the things that you actually like, because we've seen the numbers. And that's 80s big business coming in and fucking with the whole thing, pardon my language. And it's just...
Everything
comes from that. I feel like the reality TV thing wouldn't have been as much of a boom if it hadn't come from that. You know, I don't feel like certain trash in terms of the news and the sitcoms and the approaches, I think it all stems from that.
So now, Aaron, we're going to start with you for the next question, but you had a quote, you found that quote, so did you want to read it real quick before we ask our question?
Sure. Yeah, he said documentaries deal with people who live real everyday lives, but if these people trusted us and told us the truth about their lives, it could be used against them, which sometimes happened. He was making documentaries just as the communist government in Poland was really cracking down again, before they started to loosen up at the end of the Soviet Union. And so he saw a lot of censorship, and his documentaries, he felt, we're putting too many people in harm's way instead of just showing truth. It was showing truth, but also hurting people, and he couldn't stand that. So he decided to just make fictional films where he could tell truth without putting anyone in harm's way.
So now here is our next question, and this is a big one. So was cable a bigger game changer than streaming? And yes or no, and everything connected. So, Aaron, run with it.
Yes. But let me tell you why. Because I see streaming as a continuation of the cable revolution. I think that streaming is kind of the logical, technological conclusion of cable. So with cable, you had fewer ads or no ads for premium cost. You had more adult content. You had higher quality. You had a little more control of when you watched, but not much until on demand, and on demand really only existed in this brief little window before streaming really took off. And so
for maybe like 5 years, if that.
So I see streaming as a continuation of the cable revolution more than its own thing. But it is also its own thing, and the technology and the freedom of streaming has certainly been a game changer. I don't want to downplay streaming and what it has brought to the television medium. But I do see them as copacetic in a way.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's fair, you know, and we'll get into the history of cable in a little bit, but what about you, Hugh? Cable bigger than streaming?
Yeah, I agree with Aaron for the same reasons. Absolutely, absolutely. I think we can quantify. I mean, if we're going to look at pure numbers and reach and all those things, but there's so many things that streaming does that you can go back and find cable testing out or trying out or, you know, experimenting with, even if they maybe don't succeed at the time. And it's a success. It works better for the streamers, but nevertheless, I think it definitely has to be with cable.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I have family members that are still not sure. These are all older family members, much older family members, that are completely confused why things like the Emmys aren't still filled with stuff from the big four or five networks. You know, they keep saying, well, I've never heard of this show or that show, and what channel is it on? Does that even really exist? And, you know, that speaks to some other things we'll get onto later, but, you know, I really do think this all kind of lends to how cable really was the game changer. Cable really took television as a format and delivery system and busted it right apart, just altered it to something. I mean, where television was even at the end of the 90s, say you transported someone from 1970 to the year 2000, they wouldn't recognize television at all. They'd be completely confused. And that was only 30 years. Now try bringing them forward another 20, 25 years. They'd probably think it was a nightmare. But, now why am I suddenly put in mind of, like, Life on Mars or I don't know. I think your mention of the Sweeney earlier put me in mind of that because, you know, of course, Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes definitely have Sweeney DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that was the whole point. The Sweeney hadn't been in reruns at that point, and they were very much – that was the whole point of trying to do a kind of recreation. But there was also, to use modern parlance, there was also a slight sense of woke approach, as it were, to, oh, look, modern liberal English guy goes back to the 70s and discovers how horrible it really was.
Some of John Sims' best work, honestly.
Oh, absolutely. That is without question. But I've never been a big fan of it compared to the original, I should say. I think, especially now I've gone on to work on the original and get a chance to kind of really delve into its history and its making, I definitely prefer the shows they're attempting to comment on to the way they commented on themselves. But the problem is they're too in love with the untrammeled machismo of the era. And even though they want to comment on it, ultimately they are bedazzled by it. And you know, I think that's a failing. I think Ashes to Ashes works better because it works so much better because we change it up and we go, right, it's not just the 80s, but we're also going to have one of the best actresses we have on television in this now, and we're going to really dig into it.
Ashes, I finally was able to watch a few episodes of that. I haven't been able to finish it, but the few that I've seen, way better than Life on Mars. And Life on Mars is a perfectly fine little show, but yeah.
Yeah.
So what about you, Perry?
I'm going to, just for fun, I'm going to argue the other side of it. I'm going to argue that streaming is bigger. I agree with everything Aaron, you said. That was perfectly said. I agree with you that it is a continuation of cable. But here's, and I've said this before, I'm going to say it again. I'm gonna break that distinction of what cable is. If we're talking about basic cable, the game changer there is only in terms of what was acceptable to see on television, right? It changed the standards of what was allowable because it did pull network television along a little bit. But it didn't change the game. The game was still right for that commercial break. And I want to clarify, when we've been talking about this, I'm not saying that necessarily makes anything bad. It's just a rhythm that everybody in America absorbed and knows, whether they know it or not. They feel it. It's incredibly familiar. And so what HBO And now the streamers, their great accomplishment to me is they've busted the clock, like Howard Stern did. And with Howard Stern's content that was so revolutionary, it's that you never knew when he was going to stop. He broke the clock. It was brilliant. I not only didn't know what he was going to say, I didn't know when he was going to say it. I want to keep watching. I love the fact that I can watch a series on HBO that is supposedly an hour-long show, and an episode might be 41 minutes, and it might be an hour 14. It's however long they need to tell the story. And the same way that, you know, we all like to pee on Laserdiscs now, but Laserdiscs made letterboxing acceptable. Everybody understood.
Yep.
Because of, and yeah. So if for no other reason, I'm so glad we went through the Laserdisc phase. This is what, at its best, streaming will do, and it's the way streaming really is changing the game. It's changing the way stories are being told on what we call television. That's a bigger deal to me.
Yeah, no, that's spot on, actually. That's a really good point.
Well, I know that, you know, I know that I heard a producer, I want to say it might have even been Ryan Murphy, was asked, you know, they brought up the question that you, the topic you just brought up, that episodes are not exactly of a uniform length anymore. And he said, well, it doesn't really matter because this is all going to disc and streaming and people are going to be able to binge it. And maybe they only have a half hour or 45 minutes to themselves this day so they can watch it. Our next short episode, and then we'll hit them with an hour and a half episode the week after that, and then we're back to an hour, and we don't need to worry about anything except, well, telling the story. And I think that actually is interesting, is the way that cable and streaming have kind of looped in on each other, and it's, for me, it's really helped the telling of stories and getting back to worrying about stories rather than, as you brought up, Perry, the commercial break. Even where there are commercial breaks, it's not as big a consideration as it used to be. You know, keeping on this topic, and this is going to be a kind of a two-part question that follows up this. How did the rise of cable push the over-the-air networks? And, well, I'm not going to ask the second question yet, but I'll just ask that first question because I think we kind of got the second question right here with you, Perry. So, Hugh, how did the rise of cable push over-the-air networks?
So I think certainly my understanding. I would like to. I'm tempted to leave America for you guys because I think that's, you know, what you guys know about. And also, while I have read and researched it, for me, a lot of it was really new and eye-opening. I hadn't realized just how early on HBO had started. I hadn't realized the way it had built itself up from one geographical region and the way that pay-per-view sports was absolutely crucial to its development. You know, for me, I only came across the name HBO in the 80s when I started seeing TV movies they'd made being shown on ITV. Late night in one region, and then coming out on VHS, you know, and the revolution in drama that they brought about in the 90s was something that I was only in on because by that point I was following producers, writers, rather than just actors, and, you know, with Tom Fontana doing Oz, I was like, okay, you know, I want to know what this is all about, I want to understand how this sort of thing can happen, but at the same time, you know, it felt in some ways like what it was doing was something that we already had here. It felt like it was moving towards the BBC model. And particularly when you now look at read the various books that collect, you know, face-to-face interviews and so forth. And, you know, Fontana in particular talks about how, you know, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy who was HBO, Chris something, who'd moved over there from network TV.
Chris Albert?
You know, just rang him up and said, I think so, yeah. He was saying, yeah, you know, oh, I need a show, you know, can you give me something? And Tom writes him a pilot, and he's like, yeah, no, actually, I write the rest of it. You know, I want to see the, you know, we'll just do the whole thing. You know, and it was just like, you know, every year he was like, are we doing another season? Yeah, we want another season. Just do it, you know. And that is so early BBC, it's not true. You know, there's just nobody's talking about numbers, ratings. Nobody's talking about anything other than number of episodes and budget. You know, this is how much, you want this? Okay, fine, well, we can do that. I think in England, the big thing about what cable did here was it allowed for programming that was not allowed, considered mainstream, to find a home and start to influence people. So having my first job in DVD was in film and TV was in anime, in Japanese animation. And one of the things that made Britain the least attractive market for animation for a lot of Japanese companies to sell it was the fact that we were one of the only countries that didn't have a history of Japanese dubbed imports. Like we did in the late 70s, and then it just fell away in the 80s. Whereas the French and the Italians were going into co-production deals and filling up children's TV with, you know, Japanese anime, which has led to a booming market this century. We didn't have any of that.
Wasn't that a French, Italian, Japanese co-production? Didn't it take all three of them to do the Littles?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. There's a few out there. Yeah, absolutely. And they were successful as well. And that really changed their TV landscape. But for Britain, where, you know, I when I started working, you know, we had these small pockets of fans, and one of the things the 3 years that we tried to run a TV magazine online that failed completely, which is why you guys have never heard of it. My colleague on it, John Bull, who's a commentator on various things on British radio, as well as he calls himself a lapsed historian. He put together a brilliant idea for an article that we never got a chance to publish, but he's since started drafting it for online, which is how cable allowed for Robotech to get shown in a very, very small geographical subset of Britain. And so we had Robotech fans, but only if you grew up in a certain time and place. And that in itself, but that became a seed for the fans that I then had to go out and discover and sell DVDs to. And it's just one of those things where cable did that. You know, I mean, when reality TV came along, I was seeing Channel 4 used to fill some space late at night here with compilations of American, I think it was New York-based public access stuff. And I used to find that stuff mad but fascinating. And so when reality TV came along, I was like, oh, okay, we're going to commercialize that stuff now. Well, you know, this is where the guys with the money get their hands on that stuff and turn it into something. And again, you know, that sort of stuff would sort of cable was almost like, you know, it was almost like leakage at the edge of reality. You know, there's these weird things coming. You go and meet someone, they say, have you seen this? No, never even heard of it. Oh, but I watched it every week when I was a kid. You know, and it just kind of, and gradually these things come to the mainstream bit by bit. But I feel like that's our equivalent over here of what you're saying about dragging the networks forward in content, in narrative, in things that you realize there's a market for, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly. excuse me. So, Aaron, what about you?
The very first thing that came to my mind when you asked this question was, do you remember when ABC advertised for 2 weeks the NYPD Blues was going to use the word shit?
Yep,
I do.
That's what cable did for network TV in America. Like,
yep, and people were freaking out because,
but really, like it brought adult content to the network, and yeah, they had to put it on 10 o'clock, but it happened.
Yep. I mean, you know, I mean, NYPD Blue, talk about it. Not that there's a game changer. I mean, you know, in the first three, four minutes of the show, you got a drunk cop, fucking up a court case, and the DA's mad at him, calls him a soused idiot, I think is how she put it, and then she said, I would use better language, but in your current condition, I don't believe you're up to understanding it. And he says, oh, what? And she says something about ipso facto, just stay downwind of me. I haven't seen this in years, but I do remember this part, the part that made a lot of networks, network affiliates, drop it. He grabs his crotch and says, oh, well, ipso dis, you prissy bitch.
Pissy bitch, yeah.
And, you know, the thing is I remember Jeff Jarvis of the critic for TV Guide being both impressed and horrified that they put that in there. And he said, well, you know, Hill Street Blues pushed television forward, but didn't stoop to this level. Now, by the end of the first season, he was lapping it all up and understood that there was a point to it. But, you know, it really did. And it's a good thing that you brought that up because, you know, NYPD Blue really is one of the shows where you can feel the push from cable.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
So what about you, Perry?
No, I think that covers it all really great. Yes. that's the perfect show to encapsulate what cable did to network TV.
Yeah.
In all the best ways.
So,
I mean that in all the best ways.
Yep. So now this is going to touch back on the comment that I made earlier, but and this is going to be for you, Aaron. What does it say that the Emmys – and, you know, the Globe's television portion, have largely been a cable and or streaming gala for the better part of the last, say, 15 years?
Well, literally what it says is that they have less to worry about as far as content advisories from the government. They're able to make shows for grown-ups that grown-ups want to watch and that grown-ups can relate to because the FCC doesn't regulate them the same way that they do the broadcast networks. Well, let's look at the Super Bowl this last year. The halftime show, which was the opposite of offensive, unless, you know, you're racist, got something like 1,000 FCC complaints just for existing on network TV. There was nothing in it. There was no swearing. There was no lewd dancing. There were no wardrobe malfunctions. And yet it was one of the most reported Super Bowl halftime shows ever because it existed. And it existed in a very divided and charged America. And cable networks, the more premium you get, the less they have to deal with it. Though FX has really made a niche for itself where it's really not caring at all what the FCC has to say.
Can I just join in here for a second and say I remember, you know, FX has been pushing boundaries for years, going all the way back to at least Nip Tuck. But when I first went, what the fuck? Are they really finally doing what Europe and the UK have been doing for decades? I went, my God, they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I was watching season one of American Crime Story, the O.J. Simpson trial. and they had Sarah Paulson as Marcia Clark become frustrated as she's looking at legal papers and go, ah, fuck. And I'm like, wait, whoa. Because it was television with commercials. Yes, it was premium base, premium cable. It wasn't premium cable, super basic cable, sorry. But it, and yes, it was given an MA rating. But even when you see that, you typically don't see the F word. You know, I mean, episodes of Breaking Bad got MA ratings, and that was because of drug content, violence, and some nudity, you know, a flash of a boob here or whatever. But not like that, not like what they did. And that show, and well, I also mentioned Breaking Bad, but that show on Breaking Bad really helped push it forward in terms of what you can expect from shows in the U.S. that have commercials. Because, you know, 10, 20 years ago, you wouldn't have heard that word if there was a commercial anywhere near it. I mean, well, aside from Eamon Goetz saying it's fucking cold in Schindler's List and NBC had to get the Ford Foundation to pay the FCC off to allow them to do it nearly uncut or uncut and nearly commercial-free. And, you know, because the FCC would say, said, well, no, no, no. We don't care that it's an important part of the movie. You can't show the violence and you can't have the three or four swear words. No, 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 no. And the Ford Foundation stepped in and paid money. Now no one gives a shit. But sorry, I think I got us off track a little bit, so please get us back.
Well, that was basically the end of it. Like, the broadcast networks simply have too broad of a base and too because understand FCC fines people based on complaints, not based on actual content.
Yep. So, or sometimes even assumed complaints. They're like, oh, nope.
Right.
You can't do this. You can air it, but we're going to fine you for airing it.
Right. So the it's just an uphill battle because award shows are always going to want to be perceived as being for grown-ups.
Unless someone slaps someone, but let's love that.
So, and that's it. Like, streaming and cable can show more content. They can show more realistic content. And because of that, they're going to get more rewarded. And they also don't have to play to the lowest common denominator, which networks have to do just on principle.
Excuse me again. So Perry, question is, so what does it say that the Emmys have largely been a cable and or streaming gala for the best part of 15 years? What do you think it says about the rise of cable and streaming?
What it says to me is that the, and this hurts to say, the Television Academy is way sharper about what's going on than the Motion Picture Academy. Okay. And I think that has to do with the fact that there isn't, the television industry is way more spread out than the movie industry. There isn't this skeletal vestige of this epic monolith that existed forever and ever. It's gone. It's all gone for TV. And so, you know, they're not afraid to actually give the most interesting stuff awards. And they're not hampered by, Dune winning every possible technical award, which is the most boring thing on the planet to have happened to the Oscars.
Oh God!
Like that's just that is the power of a huge studio saying, this is going to win now, and it does. And so the problem is it doesn't matter because nobody cares.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it took
the Emmys, like the Grammys, are a number that you get at the end of your name after you die for how many Emmys you won. It does. So, it shows a self-awareness that is admirable, and I don't.
Oh no, but you know, I mean, but it's interesting that you said they're a little sharper and a little more daring. I think they've become a little less so the last few years with the way they've changed the voting, but for a good 10 years or so, they were really smoking. I mean, they were taking risks, because something like, say, Mr. Robot, which I didn't think was a great show, but was definitely a very unusual show, got a bunch of Emmy nominations. Russian Doll, which just came back, its first season got a bunch of Emmy nominations. You wouldn't see things like that getting nominations 20, 30 years ago. And you don't really see truly daring movies get nominations. But, you know, where is all the truly daring material that we call television? Where is it coming from? It's coming from cable and streaming. And it doesn't necessarily have to come from HBO, Showtime, Cinemax, Stars. We've mentioned FX and a few other stations, AMC, Cartoon Network, Adult Swim. It's not coming from ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, and the CW by and large. Not anymore.
Adam, put a pin in that because I want to come back to that with something later. I have a response to that, but I would like to wait.
Is it a good response or a bad response? I'm just curious.
No, you should respond. No. I would like to continue, but I think it'll do better in hopefully a question we get to later.
Okay. Now, what about you, Hugh?
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, from our perspective over here, you know, I mean, I'm going to use the BAFTAs as our equivalent. Cause
oh, absolutely.
Use
your version of it, sure.
Yeah, no, I find it interesting that a number of the shows you guys are talking about and a number of shows that, you know, have been very much, you know, like, oh, people are going, oh, my God, you guys are going to give awards to that or you're nominating it. You know, there's a number of them that are co-produced over here or they have creators from over here, and so they qualify, you know, for nomination in the BAFTAs, which is, you know, makes it more interesting, I guess. But I feel like from over here, what Aaron and Perry have said is just spot on and perfectly accurate. I do wonder. I have a slightly I don't want to sound like the standard internet movie cynic. Oh, look, you know, award shows that aren't worth it and everything. But my own personal experience working on a BAFTA campaign in conjunction with Sony in the States working on attempting to get the same film that they had the US license for into the Best Foreign Oscar list opened my eyes to just how much of this stuff is about how much money can you spend on screeners,
mm-hmm. right,
to give to members. It really, mm-hmm. really doesn't have much more than that attached to it. And I say that knowing that there are occasionally really great things that are brought to light to a wider audience through these ceremonies, but ultimately it's all about, you know, can we get more eyeballs on it? Do we have a hard copy version coming out, a physical version coming out that we can sell, you know, or a repeat planned or something?
Okay.
You know, it's in the end, it really is all that.
I think I meant the question more in like a cultural sense, you know, in perception.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But it's just one of those problems that having been behind the curtain, I find it really hard to, you know.
Oh, yeah, I mean, look, you remember that movie Pollock that Marcia Gay Harden won supporting actress for? You know, she came out, she gave this really amazing performance. The critics loved it. And people said she should win an Oscar, but she's probably not even going to be nominated because the company that's releasing this doesn't even know if they're going to be able to get it into 100 theaters in the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
I think the worldwide number of theaters or screens they got it into was like 91 or something, maybe 90.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and about half of those ended up being weekend engagements at art museums. That's how I saw it. I went to the Detroit Institute of Arts and saw it the weekend it played there. You know, and somehow...
Oh, my God,
I
saw that in the cinema. I don't know how it got... How did I do it? I don't know where I saw it. I saw it in the cinema. I just realized. Sorry. Jeez,
yeah.
Who's
you might
here?
Have seen it after. You might have seen it after because once she got the nomination, they were able to like double or triple it. But prior to the Oscars, it was only in like 90 cinemas, or 90 screens.
Right.
I should say.
See, I do. Well, this is the thing. Well, the reason we were pushing the film wasn't just because, you know, we wanted the kudos of being able to sell more copies of the DVD. Obviously, there was a sense of, you know, the reason we will sell more copies of the DVD is more people are aware of the film. And all the marketing I'd done to make the film in question a success in the cinema on, you know, on its own terms as an independent release, you know, that's all well and good, but it's the longevity you want. You know, you want the long tail. And so, yes, the award ceremony has value in that sense. It has value in terms of being able to put something in front of people. I mean, you know, the film in question was by Pablo Larraín, who's obviously gone on to much bigger things. You know, so the fact that neither campaign succeeded didn't change the fact that more and more people saw his films, and that's when he went on to do Jackie. You know?
Yeah, which I still think may be his best movie, because honestly, I'm not a Spencer fan, but then again, I don't think Kristen Stewart's much of an actress. Ooh, don't kill me, folks.
Yeah, no, I know you don't. Yeah, but yeah, I think the point about the awards in terms of the way it relates to the product. I mean, I do feel sometimes like the Emmys are catching up with the way the BAFTAs work in that sense. I also do feel like it is very much, sometimes I just look at some of the options and I'm like, geez, who paid who at the end? But, yeah, it can make all the difference. It really can make all the difference.
Yeah, well, you know, you look at something like what's happened at the Emmys, again, in winners the last few years.
Mm.
It's just been like a rubber stamp, basically. You get one, maybe two programs winning everything. Say there's 10 awards handed out on the comedy show side. Let's just say 10 awards handed out on the comedy side. One show will win 7 of them. One show will win 2 or 3. So you got 2 or 3 shows winning everything on the comedy side, and maybe the same thing happens on the drama side, and then you might see a little bit more on the movie and miniseries side, because maybe you'll see a different movie and a different miniseries. Maybe they'll give something completely different for writing, is completely different from directing, and you'll have like 4 winners, usually about 3, but still it's not what it used to be. And, you know, Perry mentioned the Dune sweep at the Oscars. That's boring as fuck. That's boring as fuck to watch that. And it's no hate towards the craftsmen and women, or craftspeople, the technicians, the artists that worked on Dune. They did fine work. But as a viewer at home, you lose your rooting interest when you see these sweeps that feel rubber stamped and that you can almost smell laziness involved in. But before we go to our next topic, because I think it's going to take a while, and we will be going into our third hour. I thought this would probably happen. We are going to do our housekeeping. which means that we're going to mention the shows that are coming up on Deviant Legion. So, tomorrow, Down the Rabbit Hole, songs about movies will be happening. On the 1st, Rock This Town Radio with TC that will happen, and that will be 90s and done. Or are they? On the 3rd, we have Rachel Loves Henry Rollins. On the 4th of May, we have ISS and FS Podcast, and the topic is Kenan Walker Renaissance Man. If you don't know who Kenan Walker is, pretty neat little guy. You're going to love him. Now, on the 8th, Rock This Town Radio with TC, Six Strings, the acoustic show, will be coming up. And for my show, Cathode Ray Mission, we will not be back next week, but we will be back on the 13th of May. The episode will be about Carlos, the miniseries about the terrorist mercenary. Some people refer to him as the Jackal. It is the miniseries directed by Oliver Assayas. It has a nearly three-hour movie cut, but the original miniseries cut, which runs for almost 6 hours, is the one that we will be focusing on. It is available on disc from Criterion. It is also available to watch on the Criterion channel if you have that. I'm not sure where else you might be able to get it. I think you can get at least the movie version off of Amazon Prime. I think there are other companies that have released copies overseas, but for those of you listening in the U.S., that is probably going to be the best place to rush out and watch it if you're so inclined. And now that we've said that, I will also announce something that I usually don't announce this far in advance. We will be back on the 20th as well with a look at the films of the Coen brothers. Yep, that's right, folks. You're thinking, wait, didn't you do an episode on the Coen brothers? Yes, we did. But at the time, we didn't know that they were probably kaput, that they weren't going to be making films together anymore. And we also didn't have the guests we're going to have. So this will be a chance to do a whole new show with a whole different perspective. So please join us both on the 13th for Carlos and on the 20th for the Coen brothers. And now back to our regularly scheduled show. So having said all that, there is, and I want to make this one quick before we get into what I think is going to take us most of the hour. And folks, please know that you'll be able to listen to us live here for about another 12 minutes. And sometime probably around 11:15 or 11:30, as long as the technology holds Eastern Standard Time, you will be able to listen to our third hour. So we're live for a few more minutes, and then we'll be continuing this conversation in a recording-only scenario. So this is the question I'm going to give to you, and I'll go with you, Hugh. Is TV better? Would you say that TV is better now than, say, 20 years ago, 30, 50, even 70?
I think if you'd asked me that in, let's say, the last decade, so in the 2010, I might have said yes. But that was before I went to work in the network and I got a chance to dig into the archives. And now I would say that it is very much a question of, if you think certain qualities define a piece of art, define a piece of entertainment, then you're going to be able to find good examples of it in every decade. You know, and this may partly also be age as well with me. I mean, doing 3 years of a TV magazine and being able to watch a ton of stuff being re-released also helped cement that fact, because you are, you know, you're even with a crew of about five journalists, we were kind of all trying to, we were trying to cover so much that you end up all specializing. And like, for example, I didn't watch Game of Thrones for like 7-8 years because I gave it to one of the other journalists and I just didn't have time. And you end up cross comparing stuff in your own mind, and you start, you know, you pick up like with the sudden advent of popularity of Nordic crime shows in Britain, you know, suddenly we're getting stuff from the 90s being issued on DVD, and I'm seeing Unit One with Mads Mikkelsen, you know, and you're like, oh, okay, so this is the Danish response to the NYPD Blue revolution. You know, except they go further with these handheld digital cameras and the way they tell the stories. And, you know, there's a post-dogma element to it. For example, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. You know, that was something I didn't even know existed in the 90s until I had access to it. So I feel like, you know, there's always something for me to discover, go back and learn in decades. And particularly with the sort of the constant attempt to find things and release them. Is it better? I don't know. I think now I feel that I think it serves a different function. Okay, I think that's the most important thing.
I agree with you, and you bring up a point that's occurred to me as I've been doing my research the last, well, the better part of the last decade with my top 300 book. Yes, my famous list. Yes, folks, it's still coming. It's just a big, long list. It, you know, something as comprehensive as I'm trying to make it does take a while, folks. But, you know, I went into it, you know, for a lot of reasons. But one of the reasons I went into it, and this is a personal reason for me, was, you know, I said, it seems like there's a lot more great television now than there used to be. But I said, is that true? And I wasn't sure that it was, but I wanted to find out for myself. And, you know, what you said about, you know, it basically depends on what you value in art. I think that's very true. What you value in art and entertainment is very true. Mm-hmm. But, you know, each era has great works. You know, there's stuff in the 50s that I absolutely love. There's stuff in the 60s that I absolutely love. There's stuff in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, today. And there's, of course, stuff I absolutely hate. You know, you come across something relatively obscure like a Gurney Slade. You know, maybe you find something that's very popular that you ignored. Like, well, I didn't catch up on certain shows until late, and I learned to love them later. But yeah, that is fair. I would say that it's not so much that TV is overall better now, as it's just different. It's just different. We can get into those differences in the next hour. But what about you, Perry?
I just wanted to say very briefly. I think. The one thing I think I'm really grateful for changing is actually, weirdly, it's technological, and it's the fact that in Britain we no longer do TV shows where everything inside the studio is shot on video and everything outside the studio is shot on film. That was always, even as a 5-year-old, I was like, why? It always takes you out of the story. And even though...
Look at old Doctor Who, for instance.
Yeah, that's the classic example. But it was such a weird standard in British television for so long that even though you got used to it, I never liked it. And what really put it in context for me was seeing some Japanese television from the late 90s. I'm trying to remember the name of the famous cop show. what was it, Bayside Department? Anyway, I was being shown an example of it, and the whole thing is shot on video. There's no film inserts, but they lit it like it was film. And that was such a dramatic eye-opener for me. I was like, oh, my God, why have we not been doing this in Britain for 30 years? you know, we had the technology. So I think that's probably the thing that I appreciate the most in terms of what's changed is the fact that the majority of television looks better than it used to. It's much easier on the eye, and in that sense is more enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. So for Perry. No, it's fine.
I think this is a straight-up numbers game, right? There's just more TV now. So, yes, I think there's more better TV now. I think there's also a lot more awful TV.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm willing to bet the numbers probably shake out about the same, more or less. To answer in the absolute immediate, right, tonight, as we are talking about this, I am in the middle of seasons of what I think are three of the absolute best shows on TV right now, and I can't remember a time when I thought that. Like, there's usually,
wow,
you know, one or two shows that I'm excited to watch at any given time. With the return of Barry, that makes it three.
Yep.
We've also got the final season of Atlanta, which is brilliant because it's a commercial television show that has managed to shatter the clock. I don't know when things are going to happen on that show. It's one of the many reasons it's brilliant. And I say this is one of the best shows on TV only because I don't remember enjoying a show so much. I'm enjoying
Atlanta is incredible
hell.
Because it's not even, is it drama? Is it comedy? It doesn't matter. It's great.
Yeah, it is. And I am enjoying beyond belief Winning Time, the HBO series about the Showtime Lakers. That is just a righteously entertaining series.
You know, that's
interesting.
I was curious if that was any good.
I am loving it, but Adam McKay is on a genuine hot streak for me, and this is a fusion of Moneyball and The Big Short, and I am real happy with that. I will watch that.
So it's Adam McKay rather than the navel gazing Don't Look Up version.
Yeah, you're wrong about Don't Look Up. So
hey, I don't think that Don't Look Up was a bad movie. I just don't think it was the best film of the year by any means.
Yes, then that's fine. That's fine. But yeah, it is a really entertaining show, and you know, and to think that, you know, I'm just waiting for more Succession too. It's a really good time. There's a lot of really good TV.
You know, Succession is one of those shows, and this is probably a diversion or digression, I should say. But I just never felt that. I watched the first season, and I kind of felt like, well, is this show ever going to do anything other than rinse and repeat, hold. Now, I've been told that season two pushes it forward a little bit and season three pushes it forward a lot. But
yeah,
I don't know if I want to put myself through those characters because I don't care if characters are unlikable, but they can't also be boring. And I found them boring. But that's just me. So, Aaron, what about you?
Yeah, no, I think TV's better now. I'll say it. I think that at least American television. How about I localize it? Because it grew up. I think it needed to grow up, and it did, finally. Now, is TV as good as it was 10 years ago? No. We reached the peak in, like, 2005 to 2015. There was, like, this 10-year golden period.
Yeah.
And, like, we may never see another peak like that. But, man, like, Barry just named three great shows, and he didn't even name Marvelous Mrs. Maisel or...
Oh, so good.
Ball.
Fleabag.
Ball or Russian Doll.
We're still really hoping we'll get a third season someday.
A third season of what was that?
A Fleabag, which is not
American.
Oh,
Fleabag, sorry.
Fingers crossed.
Since I'm the producer of the show, I was getting the lady telling me that we're going into overtime in my ear. And there we are.
The Americans, which is just finished, Ozark is incredible. I just, like I said, TV grew up here in America over the last 25 years or so since.
Yep, and that all brings us to our
credit where credit is due, since Sex and the City. TV has grown up. And it's better for it.
Yep. So so now this brings us to our next question. And this is the big one, the one that's probably going to take us through the end of the show. And that is, what do we each think are, say, the top 6 to 10 series vital to the evolution of television? Shows that brought us from the earliest days, pushed the form forward artistically and or technically, and helped lead to where we are. You know, so basically mileposts, signposts along the way from the early days to today that show how TV changed. And, you know, we don't have to list all of our shows all at once, but we can start to list a few. And you know, I think now who went? Sorry, I'm. This is embarrassing. But who took the last question first?
I think I did. So.
Okay, so I was thinking it was you. So in that case, I will go now with Perry. So Perry, please take your. Your shot at this.
All right. So, assuming we're going to go round and round here,
I forget, what about that pin? What about that pin?
Oh, we'll get to it. It's part of this.
Good.
So, since I'm assuming we're going to go around and name a show a few at a time, right? So, as always,
yeah, that's basically what I'm thinking.
I decided to answer the question I wanted to answer, only because that question is so broad and so huge, and I thought, I don't know where to begin. So I firmly believe that great art comes from setting boundaries, and so these were the boundaries I set for myself. I was only going to pick scripted shows, so no news shows, no talk shows. I mean, if you want to talk about the history of the medium, you know, it's really hard not to have Sesame Street on a list like that, but I don't have Sesame Street on this list. Because I landed on 8 shows, listing them chronologically, that I think show how television evolved. I don't want to say changed, how it grew, okay? And so my first chronologically is Your Show of Shows. Your Show of Shows is burlesque and vaudeville come to television with, you know, arguably the greatest writing staff ever. One of the most amazing casts ever. And
well, you know, I mean, it was a great writing staff, but it's not like we've ever heard of any of those guys since. Neil Simon,
exactly.
Mel Brooks, Elaine May, Mike Nichols, Woody Allen, you know, Sid Caesar, Carl Reiner, I mean,
right.
Whatever happened to those guys?
Which is to say that, and I think that if nothing else, sketch comedy, at least in America, that's where it lives, is on TV. Unless you go see it live, that's where it lives. There's no place for that in movies. You know, there are comedy movies, but sketch is a specific thing. And so I had Your Show of Shows as the genesis of this conversation about the evolution of television.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's fair, you know. That's fair. Now, in my own book, I don't have much in the way of that, but your show shows gets a nod because it's really undeniable. So, Hugh, what about you?
Okay. I didn't set myself any of those parameters, but the usual thing I say to myself is I can't help categorizing things, and so for me it's more about each of those sections that Perry's talking about. So I feel like
sure.
There is I hadn't actually realized this before researching for this show. I hadn't realized that BBC Two, when it first started, the very first show they aired was Play School, which, you know, straight up standard children, you know, the defining children's TV series in terms of just showing stuff to preschoolers and little, you know, the little ones. And I watched that when I was a kid, and it was because it was still running 15 years later, and it ran for decades. And I can't imagine children's television in general existing without that particular template. And while other things would come afterwards and we'd get stuff for the older kids who came home from school and we'd start to get a whole segment of television designed around the after-school moment, you know, we leave them time for homework but then give them something else to do. And then we would get stuff for university students, you know, all of that came later. But I think I something like Play School has to come up just because it got away from the idea that we were sticking kids in front of the box for cartoons or just entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what about you, Aaron?
I went completely literal here, and possibly pretentious and douchey. You know what? I don't care. I went with Queen's Messenger, which was literally the first broadcast ever done in Schenectady, New York, back in 1928. You can't be more primal to a medium than the first thing ever aired. So it has to be Queen's Messenger. I've never seen it. I don't know if it still exists. I don't know if it's possible to see it. I don't care. It's there.
If it is, it's at the Family Center. But yeah, for you know, for me, I always, you know, I'm aware of that primordial soup of television that existed in the 20s, the 30s, and a little bit in the 40s. I actually saw a fascinating documentary a few months back on television in Nazi Germany, which was
all
propaganda. Yeah, you know the one I'm talking about. It was something I'd never even considered, but then I was like, yeah, it makes so much sense that this would have been a thing. Yeah, you know, so ignoring that primordial television and focusing on the post-war material, you know, I'm going to go with, you know, I'm gonna say that I take a kind of a group look, and you know, while I probably prefer dramas, you know, I think that you have things like I Love Lucy and The Honeymooners that, yeah, they came from other things, but there was something that they did that it pushed that forward. It pushed those ideas forward, and there was something a little bit ahead of the game with what they were doing as compared to everything else. And now that doesn't mean that what followed necessarily improved on it, or that everything that followed came from it. But I think that those are two shows that you can look back on, and also something like, say, Sergeant Bilko, though that was almost entirely Nat Hiken and Phil Silver's genius on display there, so that's harder to quantify, so that's a little harder to replicate, but you know, shows like that that you can trace the DNA of pretty much every sitcom afterwards. You know, you can look at something like a Twilight Zone giving way to other series. You know, you had anthology series like Playhouse 90 and Studio One, but the point of what I'm trying to say, if I've lost people here, because I tend to do that when I do this, and I apologize. It is getting late for me, but it's that really for me, as much as I wanted to focus this on 8 or 10 shows, it's almost impossible, isn't it? It really is almost impossible to just point to that. But at the same time, you kind of can say, you know, these two or three in this era really were probably what helped push us into the next era. And, you know, that's fun. But, you know, you may choose 3 or 4 different ones than I choose, and that doesn't mean that either of us are wrong. It just means that there's that much out there. Because, you know, Perry even mentioned the volume of TV now. I think I read something that there's like 2,600 scripted shows worldwide now. Jesus Christ. With like 800 in the United States, 900 in the United States. That's just unbelievable. When you go back and you had 3 networks and they weren't broadcasting all day, it's a little easier to find those shows that push things forward, or at least that helped change television. So back to you, Perry. What would your next point be?
Coming out of your show of shows, I will absolutely name something that you named in that list of shows. I Love Lucy. I Love Lucy has defined how television sitcoms looked to this day. And the content was groundbreaking in ways at the time. I Love Lucy. I think you cannot. And again, I want to be clear. I have picked shows that I think tell a story about the history of television. I'm not picking my favorite shows. I'm not picking the best shows. I'm picking all shows I think are good. But I Love Lucy is just gargantuan in the history of television.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, I definitely prefer Honeymooners, but I Love Lucy probably had a greater impact, although both shows, and interestingly, you know, Desi Arnaz and Jackie Gleason knew each other, and they were two of the major guys that decided, you know, we're going to take control of our content, and we're going to preserve it, and you're not going to fuck with it, and they did that. And Desi Arnaz, of course, had the fortune of working with Carl Freund, the great cinematographer who worked on films with Murnau, among other directors. And together, Desi Arnaz and Carl Freund created the multicam system. And as you said, that defined the look for sitcoms to this day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I Love Lucy, you know, say what you will about it, folks, but its impact on television is undeniable. So, Hugh?
So you mentioned a couple of American shows, and I'm going to talk about British equivalents of them. I think it needs to be – I don't think we can underestimate the importance of First Armchair Theater from ITV, which was single one-shot plays in anthology, 1956-74. And then, which then influenced the BBC to do Play for Today from 1970 to 1984. Now, the reason I think these two matter, even though we are simply talking about something that became a fixture, oh, look, there's going to be a play tonight, you know, basically a TV movie later on, you know, it's what they would come, but, you know, there's going to be something fresh every week for the people who don't want to go out or can't go to the cinema or what have you. But what's really interesting about these is just how important they became for developing the whole creative industry. One of the things I thought, I can't believe I'm going to do this. I am going to name drop. I apologize. In my capacity as working for Network, I once had a conversation with Jenny Agutter about the fact that her earliest, it's a long story with a very short end, but anyway, this was after a rare screening of a print of I Start Counting, which was one of her earliest movies, and which is now out on Blu-ray finally. Anyway, one of the things in the Q&A offers was she said that some of her earliest work she's never seen in decades because it was in these one-shot plays for either BBC or ITV, and she just wondered what had happened to them, because she said the great thing about them was that at the time, as a jobbing actor trying to get a foot on the ladder in the business, you knew there was always casting every week and you could get a job, right, however small. And it was the same for the writers, it was the same for the directors, it was the same for everyone involved. You know, it created a space for creatives to develop their technique, their art, their ability. And of course, the list of directors that comes out of these series, people who've gone on into the movies, is immense. I mean, the two most obviously famous ones from Play for Today are Stephen Frears and Mike Leigh, you know? But then Alan Clark is the other great doyen of all this. And these people changed the face of what we think as British cinema. And also some of them even got to play in the Hollywood pool, you know? So I feel like those two anthologies, their existence was actually vital to the industry and the fact that the public watched it. I think that's the other part that's really interesting, is we don't have a public attuned to that idea anymore. Of saying, oh, let's just see what's coming up tonight. Something new, something fresh, something different, something you're not expecting. We just don't seem to have that anymore. Everyone wants to know ahead of time. It's got to be in the trailer. It's got to be in the ad. It's got to be in the interview. And I have to avoid – I say this as someone who works in marketing, you know, for 10 years. It's like I have to avoid the damn ads all the time. It's like, don't tell me what it's about. I just want to see the show. Let me be surprised, you know.
No. I gotta say, I know the show gets a lot of shit, and sometimes rightfully so. But Agutter's role in Call the Midwife, that's a really nice character. That's a really great character.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the one thing I can say we still do in Britain is, we give our aging performers a decent pension in terms of a show they get to do. It's usually a detective show, so I'm very glad Agatha gets a medical show.
Yeah, you know, I just forgot her name. Is it Jennifer Parfitt, the lady that plays the senile nun on that show?
But I know what you mean.
Wonderful actress. Actually, I found her and David Bradley seemingly stalking me across TV shows. early in my 300 dive, I had a period where I was watching a whole bunch of British television. I spent about 10 weeks doing nothing but British TV. And I swear, if I watched 12 shows in those 10 weeks, 10 of them had Bradley, 10 of them had her.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere I looked,
absolutely.
It's like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck?
But that's the whole thing.
And, of course, one of those
Bradley
shows was... Go on.
No, you first.
No, I was going to say, one of those shows was, of course, Our Friends in the North, and David Bradley was there.
Yes.
And I was like, God damn it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, absolutely. No, Brad. I'm really. It's really nice to see Bradley getting more time and attention over in the States, even if it's not always in the best work. But you know, he's been a fixture on our TVs over here for so long. Just you forget how good he is sometimes because of his just the sheer quality of what he's done. Great actor.
Yeah, and you know when I tell people, oh yeah, David Bradley, he's great. They're like, who? I'm like. Argus Filch from Harry Potter, and they're like, you mean he can act? I'm like, yes.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So, Aaron, to you.
Well, I hate to do this to everybody, but my next show is I Love Lucy, so.
Yay!
So I guess we're just going to, like, pretend that Hugh didn't just give this really awesome lecture, not lecture. I'm losing my words, guys.
No, it's okay. I'll go with lecture. I've done lectures before.
All right. About the very important BBC plays, and they did. They were monumental, but I'm back to I Love Lucy, so...
Yeah, you know, those plays for today and the Wednesday plays and all that, those are great. I mean, Whistle and I'll Hear You remains one of the, yes, cheapest, but also most effectively presented ghost stories TV's ever had.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it was literally a piece of cloth on a string. But back to you, Perry.
We're going to skip ahead a little over a decade. Okay, a lot more than a decade. this is the one show that kind of, it didn't break my rules because I followed my rules, but I intended to stick with a very sort of American story here. But I think there's a British show that enough people saw over here and had enough influence to get blogged on this list, and that's The Prisoner.
There you go.
Because it is, I maintain that with almost no changes to any of those scripts, you could get somebody at HBO or Netflix or wherever to put that on now. It's still just the way it plays with genre, the way it doesn't resolve in any sort of conventional way whatsoever. I think of The Prisoner as the birth of what would later be called peak TV. And it feels like you can do it. Like, it's here instead of Twin Peaks for me. I adore Twin Peaks. I think Twin Peaks is one of the greatest things that's ever been on television, but nobody can really do what David Lynch does. And The Prisoner seems attainable. That's why The Prisoner.
That's a really cool way of looking at it. I must admit, for all most of the 90s and the noughties, if everyone said to me, what was your favorite TV show, I used to always say, it's The Prisoner and Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, those are two great shows. I definitely prefer Twin Peaks to The Prisoner, but I have a lot of respect for The Prisoner. I mean, I've got The Prisoner, I think.
Well, you did a whole show on it.
Yeah, you and Bill were on it. I like I said, it's in my top 25. I mean, it's a fine show. I mean, you know. So next to you, Hugh, what would your next be?
All right, so I'm a little torn on this one because it was so underseen. And, I can't believe I'm doing this. So I'm going to say The Strange World of Gurney Slade, right? Not because it had a huge impact or changed everything, although anyone who, you know, it's like people used to say about Woodstock. If you said you saw it, if you said, you know, you were there, you probably weren't, kind of thing, right? So few people saw it, but enough people in the business saw it that it was influential. But I think the reason I want to put it in there is because when you talk about the thing that influences teenage David Bowie to become David Bowie.
Yes.
That kind of changes the world.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
when you're looking at where Bowie starts his journey as an artist, he's like, that's the TV show I was obsessed with. I dressed like that. I talked like that. And he starts to take that form of the way he speaks into his music in his first couple of albums. And you're like, okay, that's important. That's like a big deal because you're taking a guy. I mean, look, we know that connects us to Twin Peaks right there, right? You know, I just find that one of those weird little things where something super radical, super different that absolutely failed as an experiment in terms of commercial success. You know, getting canceled 2 episodes in and only making it to 6 episodes, barely being seen by anybody in one region in Britain until we did.
And then giving a finger to the network, knowing they were going outdoor.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, completely, absolutely ahead of its time. You know, the interactions with the adverts and the talking dog and just all of that stuff. And you're just like, this is nuts. But it, you can't, you know, it evolves the form, but it doesn't evolve it in a way that anyone saw, except for the handful of producers who went, oh, okay, we can now do stuff. I mean, Milligan always said that that's what he based Q on. The Pythons always said that gave them an idea as to how they could do, you know,
yeah,
fine
and
circuit.
There's the thing, Spike Milligan and the Pythons and David Bowie. So there,
yeah,
there's how
so
it helped
there you
push
go.
Things
there
forward
go.
And evolve
it. That's it. Yeah.
So,
yeah, so
there we have it. So, Aaron, you?
I'm jumping way ahead now to Hill Street Blues.
Hey.
I really think that this is like adolescent television. I talked about TV growing up finally earlier, and this was one of the shows that really kicked that growing up process off. Especially in the crime genre, the cop genre, having characters who weren't necessarily white hats or black hats, but were developed three-dimensional characters who did not always do the right thing. It's a show that you can feel its age now. Adam can attest that I've had my own struggles with this show.
Oh, yeah.
But it's also a show that just you can feel its import on the medium. Even if it's not working for you. So that's why it's here.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's interesting that you you went with that. You know, I'm gonna do a few more shows myself now. And I will say, you know, you go into the 60s and you have, because, you know, technically the Twilight Zone began in the 50s, but it's an early 60s show. You have the Twilight Zone.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Star Trek. And you have things like, yeah, you know, you have the Dick Van Dyke Show. but you also get all those rural sitcoms. All those things like, you know, Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. I actually think Bewitched is a decent show and a much better show than I Dream of Jeannie. But you get a lot of the sameness, that vast wasteland that we're not going to get a chance to really discuss tonight. And then in the 70s, you get Norman Lear doing All in the Family, and you get Metcalf and Company doing... and Reynolds doing MASH. Then later you get, Rockford Files. You get Stephen J. Cannell doing the Rockford Files. And Stephen J. Cannell hires this writer. Nobody knows what happened to him. I hear he created a show called The Sopranos, a guy by the name of David Chase. there's this guy named Stephen Bacho, and he's watching this, and he says, you know, that's interesting that they've done a detective show that tries to avoid a lot of the cliches of the last 20 years of television. I wonder what would happen if I did a show about cops with some real verisimilitude. And, that's Hill Street Blues. So, you know, you have these shows that just push things forward, but then it's stagnated. And unfortunately, between the 50s and the 80s, there's a lot of stagnation. That's not to say there's not a lot of great stuff, but there's also a lot of sameness. But then around the time of Hill Street Blues, you start getting a lot of diversity. You get things in the 80s like, well, Perry and I did a show on St. Elsewhere. And we talked about St. Elsewhere's import. And, you know, So there's all that, and I think I'll leave my part of it right there because now I've brought it up into the 80s as well. So what about you, Perry? What's your next show?
Oh, I haven't entered the 80s yet. I got one last holdover.
Oh, I know. I'm
70s.
Just saying.
Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night Live is, I'm going to go ahead and make the grand case that the single most influential television entity on American entertainment. Right? I don't think that this can be argued. Movies and television. There's nothing. There's nothing that's launched as much. I mean, not to mention the fact that Lorne Michaels owns all of late night now. All of NBC's late night. I mean, there was a period not too long ago when Saturday Night Live got a higher rating than all of NBC's primetime lineup. And I have it on this list, especially talking about the history of television, because it is the first show I can think of that was very consciously postmodern and commenting on television itself in a really broad way. Yes, Ernie Kovacs was doing it, but Saturday Night Live made it in a weird way, you know, institutionalized anti-authoritarianism. And that still holds. And so I think Saturday Night Live is I don't think you can tell the history of television without that show.
So what about you, Hugh? What's your next one?
Okay, so I've been sticking to British shows all this time. and it's not to say I don't absolutely adore everything you guys are talking about, and I've watched it all. And, you know, I can't say how important American TV is to me. And by the way, Adam, if you ever do a Stephen J. Cannell episode, I want in, please, because I've been an obsessive fan of his.
Oh, I plan on maybe doing a show on his family of shows. That would absolutely be great, and we'll have to dive into the late lamented wise guy.
Oh God, just that's the pinnacle. But even everything that was more formulaic, you know, even the stuff that he didn't like, but which was hugely successful, I want to talk about it all because it's just I've watched it, I just saw it so much. Anyway, let me backpedal because you mentioned the Rockford Files, which I adore, so I'm going to leave it out there. I want to skip. I'm going to just leap ahead to the 90s. I want to talk about Homicide. Okay.
Yeah.
Simon is my other obsession. And, you know, I think, because we've mentioned Twin Peaks, right? And we've mentioned sort of this, the movie directors coming into TV or movie directors coming from TV. But the thing, I think Homicide, you know, you got NYPD Blue and ER, which changed the way TV looked and sounded, American TV looked and sounded. Well, to be fair, it changed everybody's. There was a short-lived British homage to NYPD Blue set in Sheffield that was just such a blatant rip-off. It was unbelievable. Whereas we did a medical show that looked like ER, but was really, really much, much grimmer from the guy who would go on to do Line of Duty. But Homicide was like nothing else I'd seen on British TV, even though we'd started to see post-Hill Street Blues influence. It was like, it wasn't like Hill Street Blues. It moved it on from Hill Street Blues. You can't underestimate Barry Levinson in the context of, alongside Tom Fontana and the rest, but Levinson's vision of how you show the street, how you show the reality of things in a dramatic context on a medium. The cast, I mean, the cast, oh my God. You know, it's just just so many great, not even just like the performances, but faces and voices, you know, faces that
it was stuff that you wouldn't expect to see in a network show because these were character actors. These weren't young people with high cheekbones. These were worn character actors. It was John Pluto and Ned Beatty and Yaphet.
Oh, I know, right? I mean, Pulido was like, Pulido was the guy, the reason I started watching was originally because, you know, he's in it. I'm like, okay, cool, it's Pulido. And then you just see everyone else, and I became an Andre Broger fan from that day on, you know. And I've loved that show, I've so much. Bought all the American DVD sets long before we had any here. I think the writing's phenomenal. I think the directing is phenomenal. Oh, my God, the list of who worked on that as directors. Oh, my God. And they understood when, like every year they battled to stay on the air, and every year they were like, okay, we've got to be a little bit more commercial. Oh, look, this year we're going to be, you know, after the Super Bowl, so we need to have a helicopter in it. And yet they still somehow brought it down to earth, you know?
Yep.
They still kept
yep.
it on the street.
It's my number 12 show of all time.
Yeah, exactly. Even when Kathryn Bigelow directs, you know, an episode, it's still like, yeah, this isn't big. You know, you're not going to project this in the cinema and go, oh, man, this is movies. But it's got all her trademarks, but it's resolutely an episode of Homicide Live on the Street.
Yeah,
you know?
You talk about the directors on that show, and I don't want to steal too much thunder from when we eventually do a Homicide show, but I'm going to leave it at this because we won't go into it. But Christ on a cracker, the names of the directors on show. Holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I just wanted to say,
yeah, absolutely. No, I think Homicide stands tall and proud, and I also feel like nobody's duplicated it.
Oh, no, and for me, Homicide and Twin Peaks are more important to me in terms of pushing TV forward artistically than NYPD Blue or ER or The West Wing. They are the most important artistic achievements in TV in the 90s in terms of drama, aside from maybe Babylon 5. Probably Babylon 5 only because of the overarching plot and how that's become a thing in TV now. But So those three shows. There's some sitcoms out there, but I'm not going to get into that right now. So, Aaron, what about you?
Well, I'm going to finally actually say the show that everyone keeps saying that we've talked about, but we haven't, which is Twin Peaks.
Yay!
Well, we've mentioned it several times. We haven't really dived into it.
Well, everyone keeps saying, well, we've already talked about Twin Peaks, but we haven't. And it's time. Twin Peaks did bring in the overarching storyline. ABC cut it. Twin Peaks brought in American auteurs to the television network, which, I mean, they've been doing in Europe for years, at least with their miniseries, not so much with their ongoing series.
Just with Kozlowski and Bergman and a few others.
This show took the guy who made Blue Velvet and Eraserhead and made him a household name. That alone puts it on a pedestal. I don't think that I can overstate how monumental the first season of Twin Peaks was.
Yes, but let's also not forget that it didn't only do that for him as a director. It made him cuddly because the character he ended up playing, Gordon, is awesome.
One of the greatest TV characters of all time. I might as well, you know, get it out there that this is my favorite TV show of all time. Screw anyone who hates on the second season, including David Lynch. The second season has its problems. We can all admit that, but it is not the severe drop-off that people say it is.
It sags a little bit in the middle, but it's pretty good.
It's just that it got canceled as it was finding its footing again.
Yeah, exactly.
And they only had to find its footing again because ABC said, hey, we need to wrap up the Laura story. So, Twin Peaks. What wouldn't we have without Twin Peaks?
Well, we might not have had Homicide. Probably wouldn't have had NYPD Blue.
X-Files.
I don't think we'd have taken a chance on Web Thing. I'm not sure that shit like CSI and NCIS, which I'm not a real fan of either franchise, would have gotten a shot without network television having been proven to be somewhere that you could go a little dark and weird.
Yeah.
Those are just Dragnet dressed up. Fine.
NCIS, yeah. CSI, the first season or so was actually decent. And then the original showrunner left and it became total shit.
Well, wasn't Mark Frost involved in Homicide too?
I think there's a connection there. I'm trying to remember from what like we viewed it.
I think his brother had wrote a couple of episodes.
Okay. So anyway, Twin Peaks, total game changer.
Yep.
Mic
drop.
Absolutely. There's before and after.
So, Perry.
Here's where I hit Hill Street for all the reasons already mentioned, and so I'll take this moment to say, having just gone back through Twin Peaks last year for the first time in quite some time, yeah, season two is quite good. Season two really does get a bad rap. It's not at all bad.
No, I don't know why it gets the hate that it gets. I see. No need for it to get that hate. So, Hugh.
Okay, so, you know, I'm just going to say you guys are all right. You said everything I would want to say about Twin Peaks, so I'll leave that there. I'm not going to add it. You know, it's like, let's talk about something else completely different. I'm going to... given how huge and important what we call over here Scandi Noir... So, or Nordic Noir is the literary term. Given how huge that has become and how influential it has become on TV across Europe, like I can cite you shows from all over Europe that now look and sound like Scandinavian dramas from 10, 15 years ago. I'm going to say The Killing, a.k.a. Fort Bredelton.
Yeah.
Because that is... particularly the first season, which is the full length one, really. I should say the other seasons are technically, you know, half a season by European standards, but that first season, that long chapter by chapter like crime novel, you know, is just absolutely gripping. I never thought it would grip me. I didn't bother with this. I just used to, you know, flip channels past BBC4 going, oh yeah, whatever, you know, the Danes. And then one day I just sat down and gave it the time it deserved. I had to do a crash course in it because I was going to start reviewing stuff. And I just couldn't get enough of it. I just think it's one of the best crime shows
ever. Well, you know, I think that means that when we do our killing show, you'll have to join us.
Yeah, please. Absolutely. Absolutely. But yeah, I just, you know, there's been Nordic Noir before and afterwards. Okay. And lots of it. And we've seen a lot of the older stuff now, but that's the game changer. That's the one that looks and sounds like prestige TV. That's the one that, you know, pushes both the limits of the form and what the audience think is acceptable in the same way we were just saying about, you know, the way US television grows up. You know, with some producers, this is the same sort of thing for, you know, the European sort of hard-boiled crime story. This is where it starts to attain the level of the sort of novels that were being produced in Nordic Noir in the 90s. And you suddenly go, no, we can do it now. We can do that. But it's an original. And I think that's the most important part. It isn't just another Wallander story. You know, it's like, no, we're doing an original, and it's the location is important. The you know, like all good crime stories, you know, the actual place it is set and the people who are there, you know, the culture, that's important. The geography, that's important. You know, it all feeds in, but it's also just gripping entertainment in a way that I hadn't felt since season one of 24. You know, I was just like, every episode, I was like, oh my God, I need to watch the next episode. And how often can you say that these days, you know? Like, maybe, okay, sorry, given what Perry was saying earlier, you obviously can say that quite a bit these days, I guess. But for me personally, at the time, it was a real eye-opener.
So, now, let's see. Hugh had his choice, and so that means Perry's next, because Aaron, you just went. So, Perry?
I just got
the way around.
Or did you jump in? Sorry. Folks, this is what happens when you get to hour three and it's 11 o'clock at night. So yes, Aaron, your next choice.
Just real quick, my next choice is an HBO twofer. Sex and the City and The Sopranos. They came in on comedy in 1998 and then knocked the whole medium down the next year in 99 with The Sopranos. So that's really where TV grew up. I talked about the adolescence with Hill Street Blues and Twin Peaks then really kicked it up the next notch.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that a lot over the years. So full agreement there. I'm interested in the fact that you chose Sex and the City. Just real quick, because we only have about 15 more minutes. What made you choose Sex and the City specifically?
It came first.
One thing.
The HBO put out two shows that were monumental in their own specific genre in back-to-back years. And Sopranos is the one that always gets mentioned because it's aged a lot better. And people aren't embarrassed that they watched it anymore. But Sex and the City came first. So I have to mention it just, you know, or my ethics will, like, crash down on me, because it was a game changer. It's just a game changer that no one really likes anymore because it's stupid now.
So, Perry, what about you?
I'm going to touch the third rail here. Again, this is trying to pick shows that tell the history of television in America, The Cosby Show. The Cosby Show is the last show that everybody watched. It's the last one. It's the last show that everybody watched every week when it was on as a piece of inclusionary television. I think that that's it's unassailable. And I think it's also worth remembering for talking about how problematic it can be to really celebrate the wrong people.
Mm-hmm. I can see the I know that in the book that he did with Matthew Zoller-Zeitz, the TV critic Alan Sepinwall said that when the Cosby accusations came to light, when the truth came to light about Cosby, he was in the middle of showing his children that show, and he stopped, and he doesn't know how he'll ever go back or if he'll ever go back and what sort of context he can put it in. But he also wrote about how it was so important to television at that time and now. So that's you know,
yeah.
you're in good company there. So what about you, Hugh?
Okay. this is a tough one. I don't know. Should I say it? No, I know I'm not going to. Talking about people watching things, I think the one I've had on a list here when I was putting together a list, Quatermass Experiment. I was going to say Doctor Who, but Quatermass first. That's got to be the one. For so many reasons, giving us Nigel Neal, right? Putting science fiction and horror together on the small screen. But also, it was the first British television show to empty the pubs. Like, people literally left the pub to go home and watch television. You know, you just trying to understand that happening for the first time. Trying to get my head around the idea that that wasn't normal, because I grew up with that being normal for certain shows. You know, that's an immense, immense achievement, let alone, you know, it's been discussed for, you know, forever. It's been remade. It's been remastered. It's you know, Neil's position. I mean, I think it's 100 years now since he was born this year. I know there's a number of people who are signing book deals to talk about him this year, and there's all sorts of stuff going. But that, you know, what such an achievement on so many levels, and even, you know, even before the DVD release, when there was a screening of it, and you had young audiences who'd grown up on 80s and 90s cinematic blockbusters and stuff.
Birthday.
Yeah,
would have been 100 yesterday.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, I thought something was up, because yeah. So I just. It took something that was fundamentally, you know, it took two genres and made them mainstream, and I don't think, you know, I can't, as a science fiction fan and a horror fan, I can't thank them enough. But also, it put Neil on the map, and Neil is one of the great geniuses of British television.
Oh yeah, along with like Dennis Potter, but
mm-hmm.
So Aaron, what's your next choice?
This is actually my last choice. Obviously, TV has moved on from here, but I think it's a show that really has to be mentioned, which is House of Cards. It created Netflix television, and that created the streaming revolution. And if that show fails, who knows what we're looking at as far as streaming television goes. So while House of Cards really had one great season and one good one, and then a lot of other seasons. Its place in the history of television, I think, is – it's also a third rail show, much like The Cosby Show, for similar reasons. But – I think it has to be mentioned, so.
And back to you, Perry.
Okay, I'll wrap this up real quick. I got a couple quick ones. Next for me is The Sopranos, which, as Aaron said earlier, if this is a conversation about how television matured, well, that's maturity. That's as good as television can be, in my humble opinion. I don't know how it gets better than that. It could be as good, but that's the first sign of, yep, you're a fully fledged adult doing everything you're supposed to do. Congratulations. I'm so glad you're part of my life. But I want to talk about a show that comes after The Sopranos, and that's The American Office. Because this is a show, it is the only sitcom I can think of where the visuals matter. It is shot that way because it is aping reality TV, because at its core, it is about having a narcissist who wants to be on TV running your life. And they always knew it. This is not a retroactive Trump reading of The Office. That is always what The Office was about.
Yeah.
And I have never seen a sitcom that you had to watch like you had to watch The Office. The visuals mattered. It had a language to it that mattered, that was commenting on everything that we talked about 2 hours ago about awful about television. And they made it great. Mm-hmm. That show is stunningly great. And the pin is the conversation about the Emmys. You can talk about that era, that 10 years being peak TV. It is an absolute crime, and I hope members of the Television Academy wake up in a cold sweat when they remember that nobody on that show won an acting Emmy. That's unforgivable. That is unforgivable. And then the last thing I want to throw out there, because I, if we're going to talk about TV all night, I have to talk about this show for a second, and that's Mad Men. And I think Mad Men is the greatest achievement in commercial television that I've ever seen, because each season is like a book. And you could pick up any of them and just watch the season, and you would know what's going on. But if you read them all in order and watch them all in order, it's one of the greatest things you'll ever go through.
Yep.
So there, that's the end.
And we have about 5 minutes left now, guys. So has everybody gone through their list then?
I got one more, just one more, and that's Orange is the New Black.
Okay.
And the reason I'm citing Orange is the New Black is because my jaw dropped at the idea that we were going to do a show where we're taking one perspective from a nonfiction book and we're then going to actually turn it into an anthology show, really. And what it's really about are the people who are peripheral characters, who are side characters, who are villains in all the other genre shows. And we're going to look at it and take it seriously and take it realistically. To begin with, it becomes fast later on, which remains entertaining, but that first couple of years just blew my mind.
Yeah, the first season is quite entertaining, also pretty hard to watch at times.
Yes, yeah, but the fact that you see, you know, there's stories of immigrants, there's stories of, you know, street people, and there's stories of working class people from all over the world, America, and it's just, well, even the world, when you look at some of the immigrants from Caribbean and the situations they find them in, and it just addresses it all in such a humanizing way. And that was something I hadn't seen from American television in a long time. And I really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we've all mentioned a lot of great shows, but, you know, for me, the greatest show in TV history is The Wire. But I think The Wire is not as important in terms of pushing the genre forward as something like The Sopranos. If someone wants to argue that The Sopranos is a better show, I'm not going to say that they're wrong. I think that The Sopranos is probably a more daring show, probably takes greater artistic risks. But we've come to the end of the 90s and the early 2000s, and we haven't really mentioned a lot of stuff. I mean, you know, we've mentioned Orange is the New Black and a few other shows, but so much of our stuff was from earlier. And I think that gets to what you and I were talking about earlier, Hugh, how, you know, there's good stuff in every era. You just have to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, this is only, I mean, Jesus, folks, the shows we've mentioned tonight are maybe 1/1000th of what's out there. There's a lot of TV out there, a lot of great TV, a lot of bad TV. And this is just one group's snapshot of how TV has changed. I always like to do it backwards, and if I would say, you know, you can look at, say, how The Sopranos came out of Twin Peaks and NYPD and Homicide, and before that, you know, Hill Street Blues and the and Rockford Files, and before that, The Defenders, and things like, you know, even Twilight Zone, and then going back into the 50s, you could even maybe mention something like Untouchables or Perry Mason. You know, there's all these lineages. But all I can say is watch the TV that you think is the most interesting, but also be aware that there is a lot of history here. You know, we're coming up on the 100th anniversary, or may have just passed it, of TV's first experiments, and those early broadcasts are coming up on their 85th, 90th anniversaries. There's a lot of history out there, folks. And it's only going to continue. So does anyone have anything? You know, I'm not sure we have time to do our typical, does anyone have anything final to say? So I think, because I was just told we have 90 seconds left. So in that case, I want to thank everyone for coming and doing the show, and everyone out there for having listened and hopefully tuned back in after we went, well, podcasting. So on the count of three, I think it is time to put this one to bed and say goodnight. So one, two, three, good night, folks.
Good night and good luck.
Good night.